has failed, she said. It might be the only material that could patch up his wings and withstand the winds. As I don't see any markets nearby, I suppose I'll have to go directly to the source. The overseer frowned at the gray sky beyond.
Bad day for flying. Storm's coming.
It's the only day I have. Even as she said it, she wished that she could take the 13 into the skies when the storm hit, to train them in that, too.
Be careful, and think through any bargain they offer you.
If I wanted your advice, I'd ask for it, mortal, she said. But he was right. Still, Manon led Abraxos out through the gates into their usual takeoff spot. They had a long way to fly today and tomorrow, all the way to the edge of the Rune Mountains, to find spider silk. And the legendary Stygian spiders, large as horses and deadlier than poison, who wove it. The storm hit right as Manon and Abraxos circled the westernmost outcropping of the runes. Through the icy rain lashing her face and soaking right through her layers of clothing, she could see that the mist hung low over the mountains, veiling much of the ash-gray, jagged labyrinth below. With the rising winds and lightning thrashing around them, Manon grounded Abraxos on the only open bit of land she could spot. She'd wait until the storm had passed, and then they would take to the skies and scan the area until they found the spiders, or at least clues about their whereabouts, mostly in the form of bones, she expected. But the storm continued, and though she and Abraxos pressed themselves into the side of a little cliff, it did nothing to shield them. She would have preferred snow over this freezing rain, which came with so much wind that she couldn't light a fire. Night fell swiftly thanks to the storm, and Manon had to put her iron teeth away to keep them from chattering right through her lip. Her hood was useless, soaked and dripping in her eyes, and even Abraxos had curled into as tight a ball as he could against the storm. Stupid, horrible idea. She pulled a goat leg from a saddlebag and tossed it to Abraxos, who uncurled himself long enough to chomp it down, and then went right back to shielding himself against the storm. She cursed herself for a fool as she choked down her own meal of soggy bread and a freezing apple, then gnawed on a bit of cheese. It was worth it, to secure victory for the 13, to be wing leader. One night in a storm was nothing. She'd been through worse, trapped in snowy mountain passes with fewer layers of clothes, no way out, and no food. She'd survived storms some witches didn't awaken from the next morning. But she still would have preferred snow. Manon studied the labyrinth of rock around them. She could feel eyes out there, observing. Yet nothing came closer. Nothing dared. So after a while, she curled on her side, just like Abraxos, her head and chest angled toward the cliff face, and tucked her arms across herself, holding tight. Mercifully, it stopped raining in the night, or at least the angle of the wind shifted to stop pounding on them. She slept better after that, but she still shook from cold, though it felt slightly warmer. The small hints of warmth and dryness were probably what kept her from shaking to death or getting ill, she realized, as she dozed off, awakening at the gray light of dawn. When she opened her eyes, she was in shadow. Shadow, but dry and warm, thanks to the massive wings shielding her from the elements, and the heat of Abraxos's breath filling the space like a little furnace. He was still snoozing. A deep, heavy sleep. She had to brush ice crystals off his outstretched wing before he came awake. The storm had cleared, and the skies were an untamed blue, clear enough that they only needed to circle the western outcropping of the runes once before Manon spotted what she'd been looking for. Not just bones, but trees shrouded in dusty gray webs like mourning widows. It wasn't spider silk, she saw as Abraxo swooped low, gliding over the trees. These were only ordinary webs. If you could call an entire mountain wood shrouded in webs ordinary. Abraxos growled every so often at something below. Shadows or whispers she couldn't see. But she did notice the crawling on the branches, spiders of every shape and size, as if they had all been summoned here to live under the protection of their massive brethren. It took them half the morning to find the ashen mountain caves hovering above the veiled wood, where bare bones littered the ground. She circled a few times, then set Abraxos down on an outcropping of stone at one of the cave mouths, the cliff face behind them a sheer plunge to a dried-out ravine below. Abraxos paced like a mountain cat, tail lashing this way and that as he watched the cave. She pointed to the edge of the cliff.
Enough. Sit down and stop moving. You know why we're here, so don't ruin it.
He huffed but plopped down, shooting grayish dust into the air. He draped his long tail along the length of the cliff's edge, a physical barrier between Manon and the plunge. Manon stared him down for a moment, before an otherworldly feminine laugh flittered from the cave mouth.
Now that beast is one we have not seen for an age.
Manon kept her face blank. The light was bright enough to reveal several ancient, merciless eyes looming within the cave mouth, and three massive shadows lurking behind. The voice said, "Closer now," pincers clicking like an accompanying drum.
And it has been an age since we dealt with the iron teeth.
Manon didn't dare touch Windcleaver as she said,
"The world is changing, sister."
"Sister?" the spider mused. "I suppose we are sisters, you and I. Two faces of the same dark coin, from the same dark maker. Sisters in spirit, if not in flesh."
Then she emerged into the murky light, the mist sweeping past her like a pilgrimage of phantom souls. She was black and gray, and the sheer mass of her was enough to make Manon's mouth go dry. Despite the size, she was elegantly built, her legs long and smooth, her body streamlined and gleaming. Glorious. Abraxos let out a soft growl, but Manon held out a hand to silence him.
"I see now," Manon said softly, "why my blue blood sisters still worship you."
"Do they now?"
The spider remained motionless, but the three behind her crept closer, silent and observing with their many dark eyes.
"We can hardly recall the last time the blue blood priestesses brought their sacrifices to our foothills. We do miss them."
Manon smiled tightly.
"I can think of a few I'd like to send your way."
A soft, wicked laugh.
"A black beak, no doubt."
Those eight massive eyes took her in, swallowed her whole.
"Your hair reminds me of our silk."
"I suppose I should be flattered."
"Tell me your name, black beak."
"My name does not matter,"
Manon said.
"I've come to bargain."
"What would a blackbeak witch want with our precious silk?"
She turned to reveal the vigilant Abraxos, his focus pinned on the massive spider, tense from the tip of his nose to his iron-spiked tail.
"His wings need reinforcement. I heard the legends and wondered if your silk might help."
"We have bartered our silk to merchants and thieves and kings, to be spun into dresses and veils and sails, but never for wings."
"I'll need 10 yards of it, woven bolts if you have them."
The spider seemed to still further.
Men have sacrificed their lives for a yard.
Name your price.
10 yards.
She turned to the three waiting behind her. Offspring, or minions, or guards, Manon didn't know.
Bring out the bolt. I shall inspect it before I name my price.
Good. This was going well. Silence fell as the three scuttled into the cave, and Manon tried not to kick any of the tiny spiders crawling across her boots, or look for the eyes she felt watching from the nearby caves across the ravine.
Tell me, Blackbeak, the spider said, how did you come across your mount?
He was a gift from the King of Otterlin. We are to be part of his host, and when we are done serving him, we will take them home, to the wastes, to reclaim our kingdom.
Ah, and is the curse broken?
Not yet, but when we find the Kraken who can undo it.
She would enjoy that bloodletting.
Such a delightfully nasty curse. You won the land, only for the cunning Krakens to curse it beyond use. Have you seen the wastes these days?
No, Manon said. I have not yet been to our home.
A merchant came by a few years ago. He told me there was a mortal high king who had set himself up there. But I heard a whisper on the wind recently that said he'd been deposed by a young woman with wine-red hair, who now calls herself their High Queen.
Manon bristled. High Queen of the Wastes, indeed. She would be the first Manon would kill when she returned to reclaim the land, when she finally saw it with her own eyes, breathed it in smells, and beheld its untamable beauty.
A strange place, the Wastes.
The spider continued.
The merchant himself was from there, a former shapeshifter. Lost his gifts, just like all of you truly mortal things. He was stuck in a man's body, thankfully, but he did not realize that when he sold me 20 years of his life, some of his gifts passed to me. I can't use them, of course, but I wonder. I do wonder what it would be like to see the world through your pretty eyes, to touch a human man.
The hair on Manon's neck rose.
Here we are,
the spider said, as the three approached, a bolt of silk flowing between them like a river of light and color. Manon's breath caught.
Isn't it magnificent? Some of the finest weaving I've ever done.
Glorious, Manon admitted. Your price?
The spider stared at her for a long time.
What price could I ask of a long-lived witch?
20 years of your lifespan is nothing to you,
even with magic aging you like an ordinary woman. And your dreams... What dark, horrible dreams they must be, Blackbeak. I do not think I should like to eat them. Not those dreams.
The spider came closer.
But what of your face? What if I took your beauty?
I do not think I'd walk away if you took my face.
The spider laughed.
Oh, I don't mean your literal face, but the color of your skin, the hue of your burnt gold eyes, the way your hair catches the light like moonlight on snow.
Those things I could take. That beauty could win you a king.
Perhaps if magic returns, I'll use it for my woman's body. Perhaps I'll win a king of my very own.
Manon didn't particularly care about her beauty, weapon though it was, but she wasn't about to say that, or to offer it without bargaining. I'd like to inspect the silk first.
Cut a swatch,
the spider ordered the three, who gently set down the yards of silk while one sliced off a perfect square. Men had killed for smaller amounts. And here they were, cutting it as if it were ordinary wool. Manon tried not to think about the size of the pincer that extended it to her. She stalked to the cliff edge, stepping over Abraxos's tail as she held the silk to the light. Darkness embrace her, it sparkled. She tugged it, flexible but strong as steel, impossibly light, but... There's an imperfection here. Can I expect the rest of it to be similarly marred? The spider hissed, and the ground thudded as she neared. Abraxos stopped her with a warning growl that set the other three coming up behind her. Guards, then. But Manon held up the swatch to the light. Look, Manon said, pointing to a vein of color running through it. That's no imperfection, the spider snapped. Abraxos's tail curled around Manon, a shield between her and the spider's, bringing her closer to the wall of his body. Manon held it higher, angling it toward the sun. Look in the better light. You think I'm going to give away my beauty for second-rate weaving?
Second-rate!
The spider seethed. Abraxos's tail curled tighter. No, it appears I'm mistaken. Manon lowered her arms, smiling. It seems I'm not in the bargaining mood today. The spiders, now standing along the cliff's edge, didn't even have time to move as Abraxos's tail unwound like a whip and slammed into them. They went flying into the ravine, shrieking. Manon didn't waste a second as she stuffed the remaining yards of silk into the empty saddlebags. She mounted Abraxos, and they leapt into the air, the cliff the perfect takeoff spot, just as she'd planned. The perfect trap for those foolish ancient monsters. Chapter 38. Manon gave a foot of spider silk to the overseer after he carefully grafted it onto Abraxos's wings. She'd gotten extra, lots of it, in case it ever wore down, and it was now locked in the false bottom of a trunk. She told no one where she had been, or why Abraxos's wings now shimmered in a certain light. Astarin would have murdered her for the risk, and her grandmother would have butchered Astarin for not being there. Manon was in no mood to replace her second and find a new member for the 13. Once Abraxos had healed, Manon brought him to the mouth of the Northern Fang to try the crossing. Before, his wings had been too weak to attempt the plunge, but with the silk reinforcements, he'd stand a far greater chance. But the risk remained, which was why Astarin and Sorrel waited behind her, already on their mounts. If things went wrong, if Abraxos couldn't pull up or the silk failed, she was to jump away from him. Let him die, while one of them caught her in the claws of their wyverns. Manon wasn't too keen on that plan, but it was the only way Astarin and Sorrel would agree to let her do it. Though Manon was the Blackbeak heir, they would have locked her in a wyvern pen rather than let her make the crossing without the proper precautions. She might have called them soft-hearted and given them the beatings they deserved. But it was smart. Tensions were worse than ever, and she wouldn't put it past the Yellowlegs' heir to spook Abraxos during the crossing. Manon nodded her readiness to her second and third before approaching her beast. Not many had gathered, but Iskra was on the viewing platform, smiling faintly. Manon checked the stirrups, the saddle, and the reins one more time. Abraxos tense and snarling. Let's go, she said to him, pulling the reins to lead him a bit farther ahead so she could mount him. He still had plenty of space to get a running start, and with his new wings, she knew he would be fine. They'd done steep plunges and hard upswings before. But Abraxos wouldn't move. Now, she snapped at him, tugging hard. Abraxos turned an eye to her and growled. She lightly smacked his leathery cheek.
Now!
Those hind legs dug in, and he tucked his wings in tight.
Abraxos?
He was looking at the crossing, then back at her. Wide-eyed. Petrified. Utterly petrified.
Useless, stupid, cowardly beast.
Stop it, she said, moving to climb into the saddle instead. Your wings are fine now. She reached for his haunch, but he reared away, the ground shaking as he slammed down.
Behind her, Asterin and Sorrel murmured to their mounts, who had skittered back and snapped at Abraxos and at each other.
There was a soft laugh from the viewing platform, and Manon's teeth popped down.
Abraxos, now.
She reached for the saddle again. He bucked away, slamming into the wall and shrinking back. One of the men brought out a whip, but she held out a hand.
Don't take another step, she snapped,
iron nails out. Whips only made Abraxos more uncomfortable. She turned to her mount.
You rutting coward, she hissed at the beast, pointing to the crossing. Get back in line.
Abraxos met her stare, refusing to back down.
Get in line, Abraxos.
He can't understand you, Asterin said quietly.
Yes, he...
Manon shut her mouth. She hadn't told them that theory. Not yet. She turned back to the wyvern.
If you don't let me into that saddle and make that jump, I'm going to have you confined to the darkest, smallest pit in this bloody mountain.
He bared his teeth. She bared hers. The staring contest lasted for a full minute. One humiliating, enraging minute.
Fine, she spat, turning from the beast. He was a waste of her time. Have him locked up wherever he'll be the most miserable, she said to the overseer. He's not coming out until he's willing to make the crossing.
The overseer gaped, and Manon snapped her fingers at Asterin and Sorrel to signal them to dismount. She'd never hear the end of this. Not from her grandmother, or from the Yellowlegs witches, or from Iskra, who was already making her way across the floor of the pit.
Why don't you stay, Manon?
Iskra called.
I could show your wyvern how it's done.
Keep walking, Sorrel murmured to Manon, but she didn't need a reminder.
They say it's not the beasts who are the problem, but the riders,
Iskra went on, loud enough for everyone to hear. Manon didn't turn. She didn't want to see them take Abraxos back to the gate, to whatever hole they'd lock him in. Stupid, useless beast.
Though, Iskra said thoughtfully, perhaps your mount needs a bit of discipline.
Let's go,
Sorrel coaxed, pressing in tight to Manon's side. Asterin walked a step behind, guarding Manon's back.
Give that to me, Iskra barked at someone. He just needs the right encouragement.
A whip snapped behind them, and there was a roar of pain and fear. Manon stopped dead. Abraxos was huddling against the wall. Iskra stood before him, whip bloody from the line she'd sliced down his face, narrowly missing his eye. Her iron teeth shining bright. Iskra smiled at Manon as she raised the whip again and struck. Abraxos yelped. Asterin and Sorrel weren't fast enough to stop Manon as she hurtled past and tackled Iskra. Teeth and nails out, they rolled across the dirt floor, flipping and shredding and biting. Manon thought she might be roaring so loud the hall shook. Feet slammed into her stomach, and the air shot out of her as Iskra kicked her off. Manon hit the earth, spat out a mouthful of blue blood, and was up in a heartbeat. The Yellowleg's heir slashed with an iron-tipped hand, a blow that could have severed through bone and flesh. Manon ducked past her guard and threw Iskra onto the unforgiving stone. Iskra groaned above the shouts of the swarming witches, and Manon brought her fist down onto her face. Her knuckles howled in pain, but all she could see was that whip, the pain in Abraxos's eyes, the fear. Struggling against Manon's weight, Iskra swiped at her face. Manon reeled back, the blow cutting down her neck. She didn't quite feel the stinging or the warm trickle of blood. She just drew back her fist, knee digging harder into Iskra's chest, and struck. Again and again. She lifted her aching fist once more, but there were hands at her wrist, under her arms, hauling her off. Manon thrashed against them, still screaming, the sound wordless and endless. "Manon!" Sorrel roared in her ear, and nails cut into her shoulder, not hard enough to damage but to make her pause, to realize there were witches everywhere, in the pit and in the viewing platform, gaping. Sword raised, Asterin was standing between her and Iskra, on the ground, face bloodied and swollen, her own second sword out and poised to meet Asterin's. "He is fine," Sorrel said, squeezing her tighter. "Abraxos is fine, Manon. Look at him. Look at him and see that he's fine." Breathing through her mouth, thanks to her blood-clogged nose, Manon obeyed and found him crouching, eyes wide and on her. His wound had already clotted. Iskra hadn't moved an inch from where Manon had thrown her onto the floor. But Asterin and the other second were growling, ready to launch into another fight that might very well rip this mountain apart. Enough. Manon shook off Sorrel's firm grip. Everyone went dead silent as Manon wiped her bloody nose and mouth on the back of her wrist. Iskra snarled at her from the floor, blood from her broken nose leaking onto her cut lip. "You touch him again," Manon said, "and I'll drink the marrow from your bones." The Yellowleg's heir got a second beating that night from her mother in the mess hall, plus 2 lashes of the whip for the blows she'd given Abraxos. She'd offered them to Manon, but Manon refused under the guise of indifference. Her arm was actually too stiff and aching to use the whip with any efficiency. Manon had just entered Abraxos's cage the next day, Asterin on her heels, when the blue blood heir appeared at the stairway entrance, her red-haired second close behind. Manon, her face still swollen and eye beautifully black, gave the witch a tight nod. There were other pens down here, though she rarely ran into anyone else, especially not the 2 heirs. But Petra paused at the bars, and it was then that Manon noticed the goat's leg in her second's arms. "I heard the fight was something to behold," Petra said, keeping a respectful distance from Manon and the open door to the pen. Petra smiled faintly. "Iskra looks worse." Manon flicked her brows up, though the motion made her face throb. Petra held out a hand to her second, and the witch passed her the leg of meat. "I also heard that your 13 and your mounts only eat the meat they catch. My Keely caught this on our morning flight. She wanted to share with Abraxos."
"I don't accept meat from rival clans."
"Are we rivals?" Petra asked. "I thought the King of Otterlin had convinced us to fly under one banner again."
Manon took a long breath. "What do you want? I have training in 10 minutes.
Petra's second bristled, but the heir smiled. "I told you. My Keely wanted to give this to him."
"Oh, she told you," Manon sneered. Petra cocked her head.
"Doesn't your wyvern talk to you?" Abraxos was watching with as much awareness as the other witches.
They don't talk.
Petra shrugged, tapping a hand casually over her heart.
Don't they?
She left the goat leg before walking off into the raucous gloom of the pens. Manon threw the meat away. Chapter 39. Tell me about how you learned to tattoo.
No.
Hunched over the wooden table in Rowan's room a night after their encounter with the creature in the lake, Selena looked up from where she held the bone-handled needle over his wrist.
If you don't answer my questions, I might very well make a mistake, and...
She lowered the tattooing needle to his tan, muscled arm for emphasis. Rowan, to her surprise, let out a huff that might have been a laugh. She figured it was a good sign that he'd asked her to help shade in the parts of his arm he couldn't reach himself. The tattoo around his wrist needed to be re-inked now that the wounds from her burning him had faded.
Did you learn from someone? Master and apprentice and all that?
He gave her a rather incredulous look.
Yes, master and apprentice and all that. In the war camps, we had a commander who used to tattoo the number of enemies he'd killed on his flesh. Sometimes he'd write the whole story of a battle. All the young soldiers were enamored of it, and I convinced him to teach me.
With that legendary charm of yours, I suppose.
That earned her a half smile, at least.
Just fill in the spots where I...
A hiss as she took the needle and little mallet and made another dark, bloody mark in him.
Good. That's the right depth.
With his immortal, fast-healing body, Rowan's ink was mixed with salt and powdered iron to keep the magic in his blood from wiping away any trace of the tattoo. She'd awoken that morning feeling clear. The grief and pain were still there, writhing inside her. But for the first time in a long while, she felt as though she could see, as though she could breathe. Focusing on keeping her hand steady, she made another little mark, then another.
Tell me about your family.
Tell me about yours, and I'll tell you about mine,
he said through gritted teeth as she kept going. He'd instructed her thoroughly before he had let her take the needles to his skin.
Fine. Are your parents alive?
A stupid, dangerous question to ask, given what had happened with his mate. But there was no grief in his face as he shook his head.
My parents were very old when they conceived me.
Not old in the human sense, she knew.
I was their only child in the millennia they'd been mated. They faded into the afterworld before I reached my second decade.
Before she could think more on that interesting, different way of describing death, Rowan said,
You had no siblings.
She focused on her work as she let out the thinnest tendril of memory.
My mother, thanks to her Fey heritage, had a difficult time with the pregnancy. She stopped breathing during labor. They said it was my father's will that kept her tethered to this world. I don't know if she even could have conceived again after that. So, no siblings. But,
gods, she should shut her mouth.
But I had a cousin. He was 5 years older than me, and we fought and loved each other like siblings.
Adian.
She hadn't spoken that name aloud in 10 years, but she'd heard it and seen it in papers. She had to set down the needle and mallet and flex her fingers.
I don't know what happened, but they started saying his name as a skilled general in the king's army.
She had failed Adian so unforgivably that she couldn't bring herself to blame or detest him for what he'd become. She'd avoided learning any details about what exactly he'd done in the north all these years. Adian had been fiercely, wildly loyal to Terrasen as a child. She didn't want to know what he'd been forced to do, what had happened to him to change that. It was by luck or fate or something else entirely that he had never been in the castle when she was there. Because not only would he have recognized her, but if he knew what she had done with her life, his hatred would make Rowan's look pleasant, probably. Rowan's features were set in a mask of contemplation, as she said. I think facing my cousin after everything would be the worst of it. Worse than facing the king. There was nothing she could say or do to atone for what she'd become while their kingdom fell into ruin, and their people were slaughtered or enslaved.
Keep working,
Rowan said, jerking his chin at the tools sitting in her lap. She obeyed, and he hissed again at the first prick.
Do you think,
he said after a moment,
your cousin would kill you or help you? An army like his could change the tide of any war.
A chill went down her spine at that word. War. I don't know what he would think of me, or where his loyalties lie. And I'd rather not know. Ever. Though their eyes were identical, their bloodlines were distant enough that she'd heard servants and courtiers alike pondering the usefulness of a Galathinius-Ash River union someday. The idea was as laughable now as it had been 10 years ago. Do you have cousins? She asked.
Too many. Mora's line was always the most widespread, and my meddlesome, gossiping cousins make my visits to Doranelle irksome.
She smiled a little at the thought.
You'd probably get along with my cousins, he said, especially with the snooping.
She paused her inking and squeezed his hand hard enough to hurt anyone but an immortal. You're one to talk, Prince. I've never been asked so many questions in my life. Not quite true, but not quite an exaggeration either. No one had ever asked her these questions, and she'd never told anyone the answers. He bared his teeth, though she knew he didn't mean it, and glanced meaningfully at his wrist.
Hurry up, Princess. I want to go to bed at some point before dawn.
She used her free hand to make a particularly vulgar gesture, and he caught it with his own, teeth still out.
That is not very queenly.
Then it's good I'm not a queen, isn't it?
But he wouldn't let go of her hand. You have sworn to free your friend's kingdom and save the world, but will not even consider your own lands. What scares you about seizing your birthright? The king? Facing what remains of your court?
He kept his face so close to hers that she could see the flecks of brown in his green eyes.
Give me one good reason why you won't take back your throne. One good reason, and I'll keep my mouth shut about it.
She weighed the earnestness in his gaze, his breathing, and then said, because if I free Eilwë and destroy the king of Selena, I can go anywhere after that. The crown, my crown, is just another set of shackles. It was selfish and horrible, but it was true. Nehemia, long ago, had once said as much. It was her most ardent and selfish wish to be ordinary, without the weight of her crown. Had her friend known how deeply those words had echoed in her? She waited for the scolding, saw it simmering in Rowan's eyes, but then he quietly said,
what do you mean, another set of shackles?
He loosened his grip to reveal the two thin bands of scars that wrapped around her wrist. His mouth tightened, and she yanked her wrist back hard enough that he let go. Nothing, she said. Arobin, my master, liked to use them for training every now and then. Arobin had chained her to make her learn how to get free, but the shackles at Endovir had been crafted with people like her in mind. It wasn't until Kaol had removed them that she'd gotten out.
She didn't want Rowan knowing that. Any of it. Anger and hatred she could handle. But pity. And she couldn't talk about Kaol. Couldn't explain just how much he had rebuilt and then shattered her heart. Not without explaining in Dovir. Not without explaining how one day, she didn't know how distant, she was going back to Endovir and freeing them all. Each and every slave. Even if she had to unshackle them all herself. Selena went back to her work, and Rowan's face remained tight, as if he could smell her half-truth.
Why did you stay with Aerobin?
I knew I wanted two things. First, to disappear from the world and from my enemies, but... It was hard to look him in the eye. I wanted to hide from myself, mostly. I convinced myself I should disappear, because the second thing I wanted, even then, was to be able to someday hurt people the way I had been hurt. And it turned out that I was very, very good at it. If he had tossed me away, I would either have died or wound up with the rebels. If I had grown up with them, I probably would have been found by the king and slaughtered. Or I would have grown up so hateful that I would have been killing Aurelanian soldiers from a young age. His brows rose, and she clicked her tongue. You thought I was just going to spread my whole history at your feet the moment I met you? I'm sure you have even more stories than I do, so stop looking so surprised. Maybe we should just go back to beating each other into a pulp. His eyes gleamed with near-predatory intent.
Oh, not a chance, princess. You can tell me what you want when you want, but there's no going back now.
She lifted her tools again. I'm sure your other friends just adore having you around. A feral smile, and he grabbed her by the chin, not hard enough to hurt, but to get her to look at him.
First thing, he breathed, we're not friends. I'm still training you, and that means you're still under my command.
The flicker of hurt must have shown, because he leaned closer, his grip tightening on her jaw.
Second, whatever we are, whatever this is, I'm still figuring it out, too. So if I'm going to give you the space you deserve to sort yourself out, then you can damn well give it to me.
She studied him for a moment, their breath mingling. Deal, she said. Chapter 40.
Tell me your greatest wish.
Dorian murmured into Sorsha's hair as he entwined their fingers, marveling at the smoothness of her tan skin against the calluses of his. Such pretty hands, like mourning doves. She smiled onto his chest. I don't have a greatest wish.
Liar.
He kissed her hair.
You're the world's worst liar.
She turned toward the window of his bedroom, the morning light making her dark hair glow. It had been 2 weeks since that night she'd kissed him. 2 weeks since she'd started creeping up here after the castle had gone to sleep. They'd been sharing a bed, though not in the manner he still yearned to, and he detested the sneaking and the hiding. But she'd lose her position if they were found out. With him being who he was, he could bring down a world of trouble on her just for being associated with him. His mother alone could find ways to get her shipped off somewhere.
Tell me,
he said again, bending to snatch a kiss.
Tell me and I'll make it happen.
He'd always been generous with his lovers. Usually he gave them gifts to keep them from complaining when he lost interest. But this time he genuinely wanted to give her things. He had tried giving her jewelry and clothes,
and she had refused it all. So he'd taken to giving her hard-to-come-by herbs and books and special tools for her workroom. She'd tried to refuse those, but he'd worn her down quickly, mostly by kissing away her protests.
And if I asked for the moon on a string?
Then I would start praying to Diana. She smiled, but Dorian's own grin faded. Diana, Lady of the Hunt. He usually tried not to think about Selena, Aelin, whoever she was. Tried not to think about Kaol and his lying, or Adian and his treason. He wanted nothing to do with them, not now that Sorsha was with him. He'd been a fool once, swearing he would tear the world apart for Selena. A boy in love with a wildfire, or believing he was in love with one.
Dorian?
Sorsha pulled back to study his face. She looked at him the way he'd once caught Selena looking at Kaol. He kissed her again, soft and lingering, and her body melted into his. He savored the silkiness of her skin as he ran a hand down her arm. She yanked back.
I have to go. I'm late.
He groaned. It was indeed almost breakfast, and she would be noticed if she didn't leave. She shimmied out of his embrace and into her dress, and he helped tie the stays in the back. Always hiding. Was that to be his life? Not just the women he loved, but his magic, his true thoughts. Sorsha kissed him and was at the door, a hand on the knob.
My greatest wish, she said with a little smile, is for a morning when I don't have to run out the door at first light.
Before he could say anything, she was gone. But he didn't know what he could say or do to make it happen, because Sorsha had her obligations, and he had his. If he left to be with her, if he turned on his father, or if his magic was discovered, then his brother would become heir, and the thought of Holland as king one day. What he would do to their world, especially with their father's power. No. Dorian could not have the luxury of choosing, because there was no option. He was bound to his crown, and would be until the day he died. There was a knock on his door, and Dorian smiled, wondering if Sorsha had come back. The grin vanished as the door opened.
We need to talk, Kaol said from the threshold.
Dorian hadn't seen him in weeks, and yet his friend looked older, exhausted. Not going to bother with flattery, Dorian said, plopping onto the couch.
You would see through it anyway.
Kaol shut the door behind him and leaned against it. Humor me.
I am sorry, Dorian,
Kaol said softly.
More than you know.
Sorry because lying cost you me and her? Would you be sorry if you hadn't been caught? Kaol's jaw tightened. And perhaps Dorian was being unfair, but he didn't care.
I am sorry for all of it, Kaol said. But I've been working to fix it.
And what about Selena? Is working with Adian actually to help me, or her?
Both of you.
Do you still love her? He didn't know why he cared, why it was important. Kaol closed his eyes for a moment.
A part of me will always love her. But I had to get her out of this castle, because it was too dangerous, and she was what she was becoming.
She was not becoming anything different from what she always was and always had the capacity to be.
You just finally saw everything. And once you saw that other part of her,
Dorian said quietly. It had taken him until now, until Sorsha, to understand what that meant.
You cannot pick and choose what parts of her to love.
He pitied Kaol, he realized. His heart hurt for his friend, for all that Kaol had surely been realizing these past few months.
Just as you cannot pick which parts of me you accept. I don't.
You do.
But what's done is done, Kaol. And there is no going back, no matter how hard you try to change things. Like it or not, you played a role in getting us all to this point, too. You set her down that path, to revealing who and what she is, to whatever she decides to do now.
You think I wanted any of this to happen? Kaol splayed his arms.
If I could, I would put it all back to the way it was. If I could, she wouldn't be queen, and you wouldn't have magic.
Of course. Of course you still see the magic as a problem. And of course you wish she wasn't who she is. Because you're not really scared of those things, are you?
No. It's what they represent. The change. But let me tell you.
Dorian breathed, his magic flickering and then subsiding in a flash of pain.
Things have already changed. And changed because of you. I have magic. There is no undoing that. No getting rid of it. And as for Selena...
He clamped down on the power that surged as he imagined. For the first time, he realized what it was to be her.
As for Selena,
he said again.
You do not have the right to wish she were not what she is. The only thing you have a right to do is decide whether you are her enemy or her friend.
He did not know all of her story, did not know what had been truth and what had been lies, or what it had been like in Endovir to slave beside her countrymen, or to bow to the man who had murdered her family. But he had seen her, seen glimpses of the person beneath, regardless of name or title. And he knew deep down that she had not blinked at his magic, but rather understood that burden and that fear. She had not walked away or wished him to be anything but what he was. I'll come back for you. So he stared down his friend, even though he knew Kaol was hurting and adrift, and said,
I've already made my decision about her. And when the time comes, regardless of whether you are here or in Aniel, I hope your choice is the same as mine.
Adian hated to admit it, but the captain's self-control was impressive as they waited in the hidden apartment for Murtaugh to arrive. Wren, who couldn't keep his ass planted in a chair for more than a moment even with his still healing wounds, paced around the great room. But Kaol sat beside the fire, saying little but always watching, always listening. Tonight the captain seemed different. Warier but tighter, thanks to all those meetings where he'd carefully watched the captain's movements, every breath and blink. Adian instantly noted the difference. Had there been some news? Some development? Murtaugh was to return tonight, after a few weeks near Skull's Bay. He had refused Wren's offer to go with him and told his grandson to rest, which, though Wren tried to hide it, left the young lord anxious, ungrounded, and aggressive. Adian was honestly surprised the apartment hadn't been torn to shreds. In his war camp, Adian might have taken Wren into the sparring ring and let him fight it out, or sent him on some mission of his own, or at least made him chop wood for hours.
So we're just going to wait all night?
Wren said at last, pausing before the dining table and looking at them both. The captain yielded nothing more than a vague nod, but Adian crossed his arms and gave him a lazy grin.
You have something better to do, Wren?
Are we interfering with a visit to one of your opium dens? A low blow, but nothing that the captain hadn't already guessed about Wren. And if Wren showed any indication of that sort of habit, Adian wouldn't let him within 100 miles of Aelin. Wren shook his head and said,
We're always waiting these days. Waiting for Aelin to send some sign, waiting for nothing. I bet my grandfather will have nothing, too. I'm surprised we're not all dead by now, that those men didn't track me down.
He stared into the fire, the light making his scar look even deeper.
I have someone who...
Wren trailed off, glancing at Kaol.
They could find out more about the king. I don't trust your sources one bit, especially not after those men found you,
Kaol said. It had been one of Wren's informants, caught and tortured, who had given his location away. And even though the information had been yielded under duress, it still didn't sit well with Adian. He said as much, and Wren tensed, opening his mouth to snap something undoubtedly stupid and brash. But a 3-note whistle interrupted. The captain whistled back, and Wren was at the door, opening it to find his grandfather there. Even with his back to them, Adian could see the relief flooding Wren's body as they clasped forearms, weeks of waiting without word finally over. Murtagh wasn't young by any means, and as he threw back his hood, his face was pale and grim.
There's brandy on the buffet table,
Kaol said, and Adian, yet again, had to admire the captain's keen eyes, even if he would never tell him. The old man nodded his thanks and didn't bother to remove his cloak as he knocked back a glass of it.
Grandfather?
Wren lingered by the door. Murtagh turned to Adian.
Answer me truthfully, boy. Do you know who General Narok is?
Adian rose to his feet in a smooth movement. Wren took a few steps toward them, but Murtagh held his ground as Adian stalked to the buffet table, and slowly, with deliberate care, poured himself a glass of brandy.
Call me boy again,
Adian said with lethal calm, holding the old man's stare.
And you'll find yourself back squatting in shanties and sewers.
The old man threw up his hands.
When you're my age, Adian...
Don't waste your breath, Adian said, returning to his chair.
Narok's been in the south. Last I heard, he was bringing the armada to the Dead Islands.
Pirate territory.
But that was months ago. We're kept on a need-to-know basis. I learned about the Dead Islands because some of the Pirate Lord's ships sailed north looking for trouble, and they informed us that they'd come to avoid Narok's fleet.
The pirates had scattered, actually. The pirate Lord Rolf had taken half of them south. Some had gone east, and some had made the fatal mistake of sailing to Terrasen's north coast. Murtagh sagged against the buffet table.
Captain? I'm afraid I know even less than Adian,
Kaol said. Murtagh rubbed his eyes, and Wren pulled out a chair at the table for his grandfather. The old man slid into it with a small groan. It was a miracle the bag of bones was still breathing. Adian shoved down a flicker of regret. He'd been raised better than that. He knew better than to act like an arrogant, hot-headed prick. Ro would have been ashamed of him for speaking to an elder in that manner. But Ro was dead. All the warriors he'd loved and worshipped were 10 years dead, and the world was worse for it. Adian was worse for it. Murtagh sighed.
I fled here as quickly as I could. I have not rested for more than a few hours this past week. Narok's fleet is gone. Captain Rolf is again Pirate Lord of Skull's Bay, though not more than that. His men do not venture into the eastern Dead Islands.
Despite the hint of shame, Adian ground his teeth when Murtagh didn't immediately get to the point.
Why?
He demanded. The lines of Murtagh's face deepened in the light of the fire.
because the men who go into the Eastern Islands do not come back. And on windy nights, even Rolf swears he can hear roaring. Roaring from the islands. Human, but not quite. The crew that hid in the islands during Narok's occupation claim it's quieted down, as if he took the source of the sound with him. And Rolf.
Murtagh rubbed the bridge of his nose.
He told me that on the night they sailed back into the islands, they saw something standing on an outcropping of rocks, just on the border of the Eastern Islands. Looked like a pale man, but not. Rolf might be in love with himself, but he's not a liar. He said whatever, whoever it was, felt wrong. Like there was a hole of silence around it, at odds with the roaring they usually hear. And that it just watched them sail past. The next day, when they returned to the same spot, it was gone.
There have always been legends of strange creatures in the seas,
the captain said.
Rolf and his men swore that this was nothing from legend. It was made, they said.
How did they know?
Adian asked, eyeing the captain, whose face was still bone white.
It bore a black collar, like a pet. It took a step toward them, as if to go into the sea and hunt them down. But it was yanked back by some invisible hand, some hidden leash.
Wren raised his scarred brow.
The pirate lord thinks there are monsters in the Dead Islands? He thinks, and I also believe, that they were being made there. And Narok took some of them with him.
It was Kaol who asked,
Where did Narok go?
To Wendlin,
Murtagh said. Adian's heart, damn him, stopped.
Narok took the fleet to Wendlin to launch a surprise attack.
That's impossible,
the captain said, shooting to his feet.
Why? Why now?
Because someone,
the old man said, sharper than Adian had ever heard him, convinced the king to send his champion there to kill the royal family.
What better time to try out these alleged monsters than when the country is in chaos?
Kaol gripped the back of a chair.
She's not actually going to kill them. She would never. It was all a ruse,
he said. Adian supposed that was all he would tell the Alsbrook men, and all they really needed to know right now. He ignored the wary glance Wren tossed him, no doubt to see how he would react to news of his Ash River kin having targets on their backs. But they'd been dead to him for 10 years already, from the moment they refused to send aid to Terrasen. Gods help them if he ever set foot in their kingdom. He wondered what Aelin thought of them, if she thought Wendlin might be convinced of an alliance now, especially with Otterlin launching a larger-scale assault on their borders. Perhaps she would be content to let them all burn, as the people of Terrasen had burned. He wouldn't mind either way.
It doesn't matter if they are assassinated or not,
Murtagh said.
When these things arrive, I think the world will soon learn what our queen is up against.
Can we send a warning?
Wren demanded.
Can Rolf get word to Wendlin?
Rolf will not get involved. I offered him promises of gold, of land when our queen returns. Nothing can sway him. He has his territory back, and he will not risk his men again.
Then there has to be some blockade runner, some message we can smuggle,
Wren went on. Adian debated informing Wren that Wendlin hadn't bothered to help Terrasen, but decided he didn't particularly feel like getting into an ethical debate.
I have sent a few that way, Murtagh said, but I do not have much faith in them. And by the time they arrive, it may be too late.
So what do we do?
Wren pushed. Murtagh sipped his brandy.
We keep looking for ways to help here, because I do not believe for one moment that His Majesty's newest surprises were located only in the Dead Islands.
That was an interesting point. Adian took a sip from the brandy, but set it down. Alcohol wouldn't help him sort through the jumble of forming plans. So Adian half listened to the others as he slipped into the steady rhythm, the beat to which he calculated all his battles and campaigns. Kaol watched Adian pace in the apartment, Murtagh and Wren having left to see to their own agendas. Adian said,
"You want to tell me why you look like you're going to vomit?" "You know everything I know, so it's easy to guess why,"
Kaol said from his armchair, his jaw clenched. His fight with Dorian had left him in no hurry to get back to the castle, even if he needed the prince to test out his theories on that spell. Dorian had been right about Selena, about Kaol resenting her darkness and abilities and true identity, but it hadn't changed how he felt.
"I still don't quite grasp your role in things, Captain," Adian said.
"You're not fighting for Aelin or for Terrasen. For what, then? The greater good? Your prince? Whose side does that put you on? Are you a traitor? Or a rebel?"
"No."
Kaol's blood chilled at the thought.
"I'm on neither side. I only wish to help my friend before I leave for Eniel."
Adian's lip pulled back in a snarl.
"Perhaps that's your problem. Perhaps not picking a side is what costs you. Perhaps you need to tell your father you're breaking your promise."
"I will not turn my back on my kingdom or my prince," Kaol snapped.
"I will not fight in your army and slaughter my people. And I will not break my vow to my father."
His honor might very well be all he would have left at the end of this. "What if your prince sides with us?"
"Then I will fight alongside him, however I am able, even if it's from Aniel."
"So you will fight alongside him, but not for what is right. Have you no free will,
no wants of your own?"
"My wants are none of your concern."
"And those wants?"
"Regardless of what Dorian decides, he would never sanction the killing of innocents."
A sneer.
"No taste for blood."
Kaol wouldn't give him the satisfaction of rising to meet his temper. Instead, he went for the throat and said,
"I think your queen would condemn you if you spilled one drop of innocent blood. She would spit in your face. There are good people in this kingdom, and they deserve to be considered in any course of action your side takes."
Adian's eyes flicked to the scar on Kaol's cheek.
"Just like how she condemned you for the death of her friend."
Adian gave him a slow, vicious smile. And then, almost too fast to register, the general was in his face, arms braced on the wings of the chair. Kaol wondered if Adian would strike him, or kill him, as the general's features turned more lupine than he'd ever seen them. Nose crinkled, teeth exposed. Adian said,
"When your men have died around you, when you have seen your women unforgivably hurt, when you have watched droves of orphaned children starve to death in the streets of your city, then you can talk to me about sparing innocent lives. Until then, the fact remains, Captain, that you have not picked a side because you are still a boy, and you are still afraid. Not of losing innocent lives, but of losing whatever dream it is you're clinging to. Your prince has moved on. My queen has moved on. But you have not. And it will cost you in the end."
Kaol had nothing to say after that, and quickly left the apartment. He hardly slept that night. hardly did anything but stare at his sword, discarded on his desk. When the sun rose, he went to the king and told him of his plans to return to Aniel.
Chapter 41. The next 2 weeks fell into a pattern, enough that Selena started to find comfort in it. There were no unexpected stumbles or turns or pitfalls, no deaths or betrayals or nightmares made flesh. In the mornings and evenings, she played scullery maid. Late morning until dinner, she spent with Rowan, slowly, painfully exploring the well of magic inside her, a well that, to her horror, had no bottom in sight. The small things, lighting candles, putting out hearth fires, weaving a ribbon of flame through her fingers, were still the hardest. But Rowan pushed, dragging her from ruin to ruin, the only safe places for her to lose control. At least he brought food with him now, as she was constantly starving and could hardly go an hour without eating something. Magic gobbled up energy, and she was eating double or triple what she sometimes used to. Sometimes they would talk. Well, she would make him talk, because after telling him about Adian and her own selfish wish for freedom, she decided that talking was good. Even if she wasn't able to open up about some things, she liked hearing Rowan speak. She managed to get him to tell her about his various campaigns and adventures, each more brutal and harrowing than the next. There was a whole giant world to the south and east of Wendlin, kingdoms and empires she'd heard of in passing, but had never known much about. Rowan was a true warrior, who had walked on and off of killing fields, led men through hell, sailed on raging seas and seen distant, strange shores. Though she envied his long life, and the gift of seeing the world that went along with it, she could still feel the undercurrent of rage and grief beneath each tale. The loss of his mate that haunted him no matter how far he rode or sailed or flew. He spoke very little of his friends, who sometimes accompanied him on his journeys. She did not envy him the battles he had fought, the wars in far-off lands, or the bloody years spent laying siege to cities of sand and stone. She did not tell him that, of course. She only listened as he narrated while instructing her. And as she listened, she began to hate Maeve, truly hate her aunt in her core. That rage drove her to request legends about her aunt from Emrys every night. Rowan never reprimanded her when she asked for those stories, never showed any alarm. It came as some surprise when Emrys announced one day that Beltane was 2 days off, and they would begin preparations for their feasting and dancing and celebrating. Already Beltane. And according to Rowan, she was still far from ready to go to Dorinel, despite mastering the shift. Spring would now be in full bloom on her continent. Maypoles would be raised, hawthorn bushes decorated. That was about as much as the king would allow. There would be no small gifts left at crossroads for the little folk. The king permitted the bare bones only, with the focus squarely on the gods and planting for the harvest. Not a hint or whisper of magic. Bonfires would be ignited, and a few brave souls would jump across for luck, to ward off evil, to ensure a good crop, whatever they hoped would come of it. As a child, she had run rampant through the field before the gates of Orinth, the 1,000 bonfires burning like the lights of the invading army that would too soon be encamped around the White City. It was her night, her mother had said. A night when a fire-bearing girl had nothing to fear, no powers to hide. Aelin Fireheart, people had whispered as she bounded past, embers streaming from her like ribbons. Adian and a few of her more lethal court members trailing as indulgent guards. Aelin of the Wildfire. After days of helping Emrys with the food, and devouring it when the cook wasn't looking,
She was hoping for a chance to relax on Beltane, but Rowan hauled her to a field atop the mountain plateau. Selena bit into an apple she'd pulled from her pocket and raised her brows at Rowan, who was standing in front of a massive pile of wood for the bonfire, flanked by two small unlit fires on either side. Around them, some of the demi-fae were still hauling in more wood and kindling, others setting up tables to serve the food that Emrys had been laboring over without rest. Dozens of other demi-fae had arrived from their various outposts, with little fanfare and much embracing and good-natured teasing. Between helping Emrys and training with Rowan, Selena hardly had time to inspect them, though a wretched part of her was somewhat pleased by the few admiring glances she caught being thrown in her direction by the visiting males. She didn't fail to notice how quickly they looked away when they beheld Rowan at her side, though she did catch a few females looking at him with far warmer interest. She wanted to claw their faces off for it. She munched on the apple as she studied him now, in his usual pale gray tunic and wide belt, hood thrown back and leather vambraces gleaming in the afternoon sunlight. Gods, she had no interest in him like that, and she was certain he had no inclination to take her to his bed either. Maybe it was just from spending so much time in her fey body that she felt territorial. Territorial and grumpy and mean. Last night she had growled at a female in the kitchen who would not stop staring at him, and had actually taken a step toward him as if to say hello. Selena shook her head to clear away the instincts that were starting to make her see fire at all hours of the day. "I assume you brought me here so I could practice." She chucked the apple core across the field and rubbed at her shoulder. She'd been feverish the night before, thanks to Rowan making her practice all afternoon, and had awoken exhausted this morning. "Ignite them, and keep the fires controlled and even all night."
"All three."
"Not a question."
"Keep the end ones low for the jumpers. The middle one should be scorching the clouds."
She wished she hadn't eaten the apple. "This could easily turn lethal." He lifted a hand and wind stirred around her.
"I'll be here,"
he said simply, eyes shining with an arrogance he'd more than earned in his centuries of living. "And if I somehow still manage to turn someone into a living torch?"
"Then it's a good thing the healers are also here to celebrate."
She gave him a dirty look and rolled her shoulders. "When do you want to start?" Her stomach clenched as he said,
"Now."
She was burning, but remaining steady, even as the sun set and the field became packed with revelers. Musicians took up places by the forest edge, and the world filled with their violins and fiddles and flutes and drums. Such beautiful ancient music that her flames moved with it, turning into rubies and citrons and tiger eyes and deepest sapphires. Her magic didn't manifest in only blue wildfire anymore. It had been slowly changing, growing these past few weeks. No one really noticed her, standing on the outskirts of the fire's light, though a few marveled at the flames that burned but did not consume the wood. Sweat ran down every part of her, mostly thanks to the terror of people jumping over the lower burning bonfires. Yet Rowan remained beside her, murmuring as if she were a nervous horse. She wanted to tell him to go away, to maybe indulge one of those doe-eyed females who kept silently inviting him to dance. But she focused on the flames and on maintaining that shred of control, even though her blood was starting to boil. A knot tightened in her lower back, and she shifted. Gods, she was soaked. Every damn crevice was damp.
"Easy,"
Rowan said as the flames danced a little higher.
"I know,"
she gritted out. The music was already so inviting, the dancing around the fire so joyous, the food on the table smelling so delicious,
And here she was, far from it all, just burning. Her stomach grumbled. When can I stop?
She shifted on her feet again, and the largest bonfire twisted, the flame slithering with her body. No one noticed.
When I say so, he said.
She knew he was using the people around them, her fear for their safety, to get her to master her control, but...
I'm sweating to death, I'm starving, and I want a break.
Resorting to whining.
But a cool breeze licked up her neck, and she closed her eyes, moaning. She could feel him watching her, and after a moment he said,
Just a little while longer.
She almost sagged with relief, but opened her eyes to focus. She could hold out for a bit, then go eat and eat and eat. Maybe dance. She hadn't danced in so long. Maybe she would try it out here in the shadows, see if her body could find room for joy, even though it was currently so hot and aching that she would bet good money that the moment she stopped, she would fall asleep. But the music was entrancing, the dancers mere shadows swirling around. Unlike in Otterlin, there were no guards monitoring the festivities, no villagers lurking to see who might cross the line into treason and earn a pretty coin for whoever they turned in. There was just the music, and the dancing, and the food, and the fire. Her fire. She tapped a foot, bobbing her head, eyes on the three smokeless fires and the silhouettes dancing around them. She did want to dance. Not from joy, but because she felt her fire and the music meld and pulse against her bones. The music was a tapestry woven of light and dark and color, building delicate links in a chain that latched onto her heart and spread out into the world, binding her to it, connecting everything. She understood then. The word marks were a way of harnessing those threads, of weaving and binding the essence of things. Magic could do the same, and from her power, from her imagination and will and core, she could create and shape.
Easy, Rowan said,
then added with a hint of surprise,
Music. That day on the ice you were humming.
She registered another cool wind on her neck, but her skin was already pulsing in time with the drums.
Let the music steady you.
Gods, to be free like this. The flames roiled and undulated with the melody.
Easy.
She could barely hear him above the wave of sound filling her up, making her feel each tether binding her to the earth, each infinite thread. For a breath, she wished for a shapeshifter's heart, so she could shed her skin and weave herself into something else, the music or the wind, and blow across the world. Her eyes were stinging, almost blurry from staring so long at the flames, and a muscle in her back twinged.
Steady.
She didn't know what he was talking about. The flames were calm, lovely. What would happen if she walked through them? The pulsing in her head seemed to say, Do it, do it, do it.
That's enough for now.
Rowan grabbed her arm, but hissed and let go.
That is enough.
Slowly, too slowly, she looked at him. Her eyes were wide, the light of the fire making them almost ablaze. Fire. Her fire. She returned to the flame, submitted to it. The music and the dancing continued, bright and merry.
Look at me,
Rowan said, but didn't touch her.
Look at me.
She could hardly hear him, as if she were underwater. There was a pounding in her now, edged with pain. It was a knife that sliced into her mind and her body with each pulse. She couldn't look at him, didn't dare take her attention from the fire.
Let the fires burn on their own,
Rowan ordered. She could have sworn she heard something like fear in his voice. It was an effort of will, and pain spiked down the tendons in her neck. But she looked at him. His nostrils flared.
Aelin, stop right now.
She tried to speak, but her throat was raw, burning. She couldn't move her body.
Let go.
She tried to tell him she couldn't, but it hurt. She was an anvil, and the pain was a hammer, striking again and again.
If you don't let go, you are going to burn out completely.
Was this the end of her magic, then? A few hours tending fires? Such a relief. Such a blessed relief, if it were true.
You are on the verge of roasting yourself from the inside out,
Rowan snarled. She blinked, and her eyes ached as if she had sand in them. Agony lashed down her spine, so hard she fell to the grass. Light flared, not from her or Rowan, but from the fires surging. People yelled. The music faltered. The grass hissed beneath her hands, smoking. She groaned, fumbling inside for the three tethers to the fires. But she was a maze, a labyrinth, the strings all tangled and...
I'm sorry,
Rowan hissed, swearing again. And the air vanished. She tried to groan, to move. But she had no air. No air for that inner fire. Blackness swept in. Oblivion. Then she was gasping, arcing off the grass, the fires now crackling naturally, and Rowan hovering over her.
Breathe. Breathe.
Though he'd snapped her tethers to the fires, she was still burning. Not burning on the outside, where even the grass had stopped smoldering. She was burning up from within. Each breath sent fire down her lungs, her veins. She could not speak or move. She had shoved herself over some boundary, hadn't heard the warning signs to turn back, and she was burning alive beneath her skin. She shook with tearless, panicked sobs. It hurt. It was endless and eternal, and there was no dark part of her where she could flee to escape the flames. Death would be a mercy, a cold, black haven. She didn't know Rowan had left until he came sprinting back, two females in tow. One of them said, "Can you stand to carry her? There aren't any water wielders here, and we need to get her into cold water, now." She didn't hear what else was said. Heard nothing but the pounding, pounding of that forge under her skin. There was a grunt and a hiss, and then she was in Rowan's arms, bouncing against his chest as he hurtled through the woods. Every step sent splinters of red-hot pain through her. Though his arms were ice-cold, a frigid wind pressing on her, she was adrift in a sea of fire. Hell. This is what the Dark God's underworld felt like. This was what awaited her when she took her last breath. It was the horror of that thought that made her focus on what she could grasp, namely the pine and snow smell of Rowan. She pulled that smell into her lungs, pulled it down deep, and clung to it as though it were a lifeline tossed into a stormy sea. She didn't know how long it took, but her grasp on him was weakening, each pulse of fiery pain fraying it. But then it was darker than the woods, and the sounds echoed louder, and they took stairs, and then...
Get her into the water.
She was lowered into the water in the sunken stone tub. Then steam brushed her face. Someone swore.
Freeze it, Prince, the second voice commanded. Now!
There was a moment of blissful cold, but then the fire surged and...
Get her out!
Strong hands yanked at her, and she had the vague sense of hearing bubbling. She had boiled the water in that tub, almost boiled herself. She was in another tub a moment later, the ice forming again, then melting. Melting and...
Breathe,
Rowan said by her ear, kneeling at the head of the tub.
Let it go. Let it get out of you.
Steam rose, but she took a breath.
Good.
Rowan panted. Ice formed again. Melted. She was sweating, heat pulsing against her skin like a drum. She did not want to die like this. She took another breath. Like the ebb and flow of the tide, the bath froze, then melted, slower each time. And each time, the cold soaked into her a bit more, numbing her, urging her body to relax. Ice and fire, frost and embers. Locked in a battle, pushing and pulling. Beneath it, she could almost taste Rowan's steel will slamming against her magic, a will that refused to let the fire burn her into nothing. Her body ached, but now the pain was mortal. Her cheeks were still aflame, but the water went cold, then lukewarm, then warm and stayed that way. Warm, not hot. We need to get those clothes off her, one of the females said. Selena lost track of time as two small sets of hands eased up her head and then stripped off her sodden clothes. Without them, she was almost weightless in the water. She didn't care if Rowan saw. Didn't think there was an inch of a woman's body he hadn't already explored anyway. She lay there, eyes shut, face tilted toward the ceiling. After a while, Rowan said,
Just answer yes or no. That's all you have to do.
She managed a slight nod, though she winced as pain shot down her neck and shoulders.
Are you in danger of flaring up again?
She was breathing as evenly as she could, the heat pounding in her cheeks, her legs, her core. But it was steadily diminishing.
No,
she whispered, a brush of hot air from her tongue.
Are you in pain?
Not a sympathetic question, but a commander assessing his soldier's condition to sort out the best course of action.
Yes.
A hiss of steam. A woman said, We will prepare a tonic. Just keep her cool. Soft feet padded on the stone floors on their way out. Then came the snick of the door to the bath's closing. There was a slosh of water in a bucket, then Selena sighed, or tried to, as an ice-cold cloth was laid on her forehead. More sloshing, then another cloth dripped freezing water under her hair, her neck.
The burnout,
Rowan said quietly.
You should have told me you were at your limit.
Speaking was too hard. But she opened her eyes to find him kneeling at the head of the bath, a bucket of water beside him, and a cloth in his hands. He wrung it again over her brow, the water so wonderful she would have moaned. The bath cooled further, but was still warm. Too warm.
If you'd gone on any longer, the burnout would have destroyed you. You must learn to recognize the signs and how to pull back before it's too late.
Not a statement, but a command.
It will rip you apart inside. Make this...
He shook his head again.
Make this look like nothing. You don't touch your magic until you've rested for a while. Understand?
She tilted her head up, beckoning for more cold water on her face. But he refused to wring the cloth until she nodded her agreement. He cooled her off for another few moments, then slung the cloth over the side of the bucket and stood.
I'm going to check on the tonic. I'll be back soon.
He left once she'd nodded again. If she hadn't known better, she might have thought he was fussing. Worried, even. She hadn't been old enough in Terrasen to have anyone teach her about the deadly side to her power. And no one had explained, since her lessons had been so limited. She hadn't felt like she was burning out. It had come on so quickly. Maybe that was all there was to her magic. Maybe her well didn't go as deep as everyone had thought. It would be a relief if that were true. She lifted her legs, groaning at the aches along her muscles, and leaned forward far enough to hug her knees. Above the lip of the sunken tub, there were a few candles burning on the stones, and she glared at the flames, hated the flames, though she supposed they needed light in here. She rested her forehead on her scarred knees, her skin nearly scorching. She shut her eyes, piecing her splintered consciousness together. The door opened. Rowan. She kept herself in that cool darkness, savoring the growing chill in the water, the quieting pulse under her skin. He sounded about halfway across the room when his footsteps halted. His breath caught, harsh enough that she looked over her shoulder. But his eyes weren't on her face or the water. They were on her bare back. Curled as she was against her knees, he could see the whole expanse of ruined flesh, each scar from the lashings.
Who did that to you?
It would have been so easy to lie. But she was so tired, and he had saved her useless hide. So she said,
"A lot of people. I spent some time in the salt mines of Endovir."
He was so still that she wondered if he'd stopped breathing.
"How long?"
he asked after a moment. She braced herself for the pity, but his face was so carefully blank. No, not blank. Calm with lethal rage.
"A year. I was there a year before. It's a long story."
She was too exhausted, her throat too raw to say the rest of it. She noticed then that his arms were bandaged, and more bandages across his broad chest peeked up from beneath his shirt. She'd burned him again. And yet he had held on to her, had run all the way here and not let go once.
"You were a slave."
She gave him a slow nod. He opened his mouth, but shut it and swallowed, that lethal rage winking out. As if he remembered who he was talking to, and that it was the least punishment she deserved. He turned on his heel and shut the door behind him. She wished he'd slammed it, wished he'd shattered it. But he closed it with barely more than a click, and did not return. Chapter 42. Her back. Rowan soared over the trees, riding and shaping the winds to push him onward, faster, their roar negligible to the bellowing in his head. He took in the passing world out of instinct rather than interest. His eyes turned inward, toward that slab of ruined flesh glistening in the candlelight. The gods knew he'd seen plenty of harrowing injuries. He'd bestowed plenty of them on his enemies and friends alike. In the grand sense of things, her back wasn't even close to some of those wounds. Yet when he'd seen it, his heart had clean stopped. And for a moment there had been an overwhelming silence in his mind. He felt his magic and his warrior's instincts honing into a lethal combination the longer he stared, howling to rip apart the people who had done that with his bare hands. Then he'd just left, hardly making it out of the baths before he shifted and soared into the night. Maeve had lied, or lied by omission, but she knew. She knew what the girl had gone through, knew she'd been a slave. That day,
That day early on, he'd threatened to whip the girl gods above, and she had lost it. He'd been such a proud fool that he'd assumed she'd lashed out because she was nothing more than a child. He should have known better. Should have known that when she did react to something like that, it meant the scars went deep. And then there were the other things he'd said. He was almost to the towering line of the Cambrian Mountains. She had barely grown into her woman's body when they hurt her like that. Why hadn't she told him? Why hadn't Maeve told him? His hawk loosed a piercing cry that echoed on the dark gray stones of the mountain wall before him. A chorus of unearthly howls rose in response. Maeve's wild wolves, guarding the passes. Even if he flew all the way to Dorinel, he'd reach his queen and demand answers and... She would not give them to him. With the blood oath, she could command he not go back to Mistward. He gripped the winds with his magic, choking off their current. Aelin. Aelin had not trusted him, had not wanted him to know. And she'd almost burned out completely, gods be damned, leaving her currently defenseless. Primal anger sharpened in his gut, brimming with a territorial possessive need. Not a need for her, but a need to protect, a male's duty and honor. He had not handled the news as he should have. If she hadn't wanted to tell him about being a slave, then she probably had done so assuming the worst about him, just as she was probably assuming the worst about his leaving. The thought didn't sit well. So he veered back to the north and reined his magic to pull the winds with him, easing his flight back to the fortress. He would get answers from his queen soon enough. The healers gave her a tonic, and when Selena reassured them that she wasn't going to incinerate herself, she stayed in the bath until her teeth were chattering. It took 3 times as long as usual to get back to her rooms, and she was so frozen and drained that she didn't change into clothes before she dropped into bed. She didn't want to think about what it meant that Rowan had left like that. But she did, aching and cramping from the magic. She drifted into a jerking, fitful sleep, the cold so fierce she couldn't tell whether it was from the temperature or the aftermath of the magic. At some point, she was awoken by the laughing and singing of the returning revelers. After a while, even the drunkest found their bed, or someone else's. She was almost asleep again, teeth still chattering, when her window groaned open in the breeze. She was too cold and sore to get up. There was a flutter of wings and a flash of light, and before she could roll over, he'd scooped her up, blanket and all. If she'd had any energy, she might have objected. But he carried her up the 2 flights of stairs, down the hall, and then a roaring fire, warm sheets, and a soft mattress, and a heavy quilt that was tucked in with surprising gentleness. The fire dimmed on a phantom wind, and then the mattress shifted. In the flickering dark, he said roughly,
"You're staying with me from now on."
She found him lying as far away from her as he could get, without falling off the mattress.
"The bed is for tonight. Tomorrow you'll get a cot. You'll clean up after yourself, or you'll be back in that room."
She nestled into her pillow. "Very well." The fire dimmed, yet the room remained toasty. It was the first warm bed she'd had in months. But she said,
"I don't want your pity." "This is not pity. Maeve decided not to tell me what happened to you. You have to know that I wasn't aware you had..."
She slid an arm across the bed to grasp his hand. She knew that if she wanted to,
She could strike him a wound so deep it would fracture him.
I knew. At first, I was afraid you'd mock me if I told you, and I would kill you for it. Then I didn't want you to pity me. And more than any of that, I didn't want you to think it was ever an excuse.
Like a good soldier,
he said.
She had to look away for a moment to keep from letting him see just what that meant to her. He took a long breath that made his broad chest expand.
Tell me how you were sent there, and how you got out.
She was tired in her bones, but she rallied her energy one last time and told him of the years in Rifthold, of stealing Asterian horses and racing across the desert, of dancing until dawn with courtesans and thieves and all the beautiful, wicked creatures in the world. And then she told him about losing Sam, and of that first whipping in Endovir when she'd spat blood in the chief overseer's face, and what she had seen and endured in the following year. She spoke of the day she had snapped and sprinted for her own death. Her heart grew heavy when at last she got to the evening when the captain of the Royal Guard prowled into her life, and a tyrant's son had offered her a shot at freedom. She told him what she could about the competition, and how she'd won it, until her words slurred, and her eyelids drooped. There would be more time to tell him of what happened next, of the word keys and Elena and Nehemia, and how she had become so broken and useless. She yawned, and Rowan rubbed his eyes, his other hand still in hers. But he didn't let go. And when she awoke before dawn, warm and safe and rested, Rowan was still holding her hand, clasped to his chest. Something molten rushed through her, pouring over every crack and fracture still left gaping and open. Not to hurt or mar, but to weld, to forge. Chapter 43. Rowan didn't let her get out of bed that day. He brought trays of food, going so far as to make sure she consumed every last drop of beef stew, half a loaf of crusty bread, a bowl of the first spring berries, and a mug of ginger tea. He hardly needed to offer any encouragement to eat. She was starving. But if she didn't know better, she'd say he was fussing. Emrys and Luca visited once to see if she was alive, took one look at Rowan's stone-cold face, heard the ripple of a growl, and took off, saying she was in more than competent hands and promising to come back when she was feeling better. You know, Selena said, propped in bed with her fourth mug of tea for the day, I highly doubt anyone is going to attack me now if they've already put up with my nonsense for this long. Rowan, who was yet again poring over the map of the location of the bodies, didn't even look up from his seat at his work table.
This isn't negotiable.
She might have laughed had her body not given a burst of twisting, blinding pain. She bore down on it, clenching her mug, focusing on her breathing. That was why she'd allowed him to fuss. Thanks to her magical meltdown last night, every damn part of her was sore. The constant throb and stinging and twisting, the headache between her brows, the fuzziness on the edge of her vision. Even sliding her gaze across the room sent sparks of pain through her head. So you mean to tell me that whenever someone comes close to burnout, she not only goes through all of this misery, but if she's female, the males around her go this berserk? He set down his pen and twisted to examine her.
This is hardly berserk. At least you can defend yourself by physical means when your magic is useless. For other fae, even if they've had weapons and defense training, if they can't touch their magic, they're vulnerable, especially when they're drained and in pain. That makes people, usually males, yes,
somewhat edgy. Others have been known to kill without thought any perceived threat, real or otherwise.
What sort of threat? Maeve's lands are peaceful. She leaned over to set down her tea, but he was already moving, so swift that he intercepted her mug before it could hit the table. He took it from her with surprising gentleness, saw that she'd drained it, and poured another cup.
Threats from anywhere. Males, females, creatures. You can't reason against it. Even if it wasn't in our culture, there would still be an instinct to protect the defenseless, regardless of whether they're female or male, young or old.
He reached for a slice of bread and a bowl of beef broth.
Eat this.
It pains me to say this, but one more bite and I'll be sick all over the place. Oh, he was definitely fussing. And though it warmed her miserable heart, it was becoming rather irritating. The bastard just dipped the bread into the broth and held them out to her.
You need to keep up your energy. You probably came so close to burnout because you didn't have enough food in your stomach.
Fine. It smelled too good to resist, anyway. She took the bread and the broth. While she ate, he made sure the room passed inspection. The fire was still high, suffocatingly hot as it had been since morning, thanks to the chills that had racked her. Only one window was cracked, to allow in the slightest of breezes when she had hot flashes. The door was shut, and locked, and yet another pot of tea was waiting, currently steeping on his work table. When he was done ensuring all was accounted for and no threats lurked in the shadows, he looked her over with the same scrutiny. Skin, wan and gleaming from the remnants of those hot flashes. Lips, pale and cracked. Posture, limp and useless. Eyes, pain-dimmed and increasingly full of irritation. Rowan frowned again. After handing the empty bowl to him, she rubbed her thumb and forefinger against the persistent headache between her eyebrows. "So when the magic runs out," she said, "that's it? Either you stop or you burn out?" Rowan leaned back in his chair.
"Well, there's the Karanam."
The old language word was beautiful on his tongue. And if she'd had a death wish, she might have begged him to speak only in the ancient language, just to savor the exquisite sounds.
"It's hard to explain," Rowan went on. "I've only ever seen it used a handful of times on killing fields. When you're drained, your Karanam can yield their power to you, as long as you're compatible and actively sharing a blood connection."
She tilted her head to the side. "If we were Karanam, and I gave you my power, would you still only be using wind and ice, not my fire?" He nodded gravely. "How do you know if you're compatible with someone?"
"There's no way of telling until you try. And the bond is so rare that the majority of Fae never meet someone who is compatible, or whom they trust enough to test it out. There's always a threat that they could take too much, and if they're unskilled, they could shatter your mind. Or you could both burn out completely."
"Interesting. Could you ever just steal magic from someone?"
"Less savory Fae once attempted to do so. To win battles and add to their own power. But it never worked. And if it did, it was because the person they held hostage was coincidentally compatible. Maeve outlawed any forced bonds long before I was born. But I've been sent a few times to hunt down corrupt Fae who keep their Karanam as slaves. Usually the slaves are so broken there's no way to rehabilitate them. Putting them down is the only mercy I can offer."
His face and voice didn't change, but she said softly, "Doing that must be harder than all the wars and sieges you've ever waged." A shadow darted across his harsh face.
immortality is not as much of a gift as mortals would believe. It can breed monsters that even you would be sick to learn about. Imagine the sadists you've encountered, and then imagine them with millennia to hone their craft and warped desires.
Selena shuddered. This conversation's become too awful to have after eating, she said, slumping against the pillows. Tell me which one of your cadre is the handsomest, and if he would fancy me.
Rowan choked. The thought of you with any of my companions makes my blood run cold.
They're that awful? Your kitty cat friend looked decent enough.
Rowan's brows rose high. I don't think my kitty cat friend would know what to do with you, nor would any of the others. It would likely end in bloodshed.
She kept grinning, and he crossed his arms.
They would likely have very little interest in you, as you'll be old and decrepit soon enough, and thus not worth the effort it would take to win you. She rolled her eyes. Killjoy.
Silence fell, and he looked her over again, lucid if drained and moody. And she wasn't that surprised when he glanced at her bare wrists. One of the few bits of skin showing thanks to all the blankets he'd piled on top of her. They hadn't discussed it last night, but she knew he'd been working up to it. There was no judgment in his eyes as he said,
A skilled healer could probably get rid of those scars. Definitely the ones on your wrist, and most on your back.
She clenched her jaw, but after a moment loosed a long breath. Even though she knew he would understand without much explanation, she said, There were cells in the bowels of the mines that they used to punish slaves. Cells so dark you would wake up in them and think you'd been blinded. They locked me in there sometimes, once for 3 weeks straight. And the only thing that got me through it was reminding myself of my name, over and over and over. I am Selena Sardothian. Rowan's face was drawn, but she went on. When they would let me out, so much of my mind had shut down in the darkness that the only thing I could remember was that my name was Selena. Selena Sardothian, arrogant and brave and skilled. Selena, who did not know fear or despair. Selena, who was a weapon honed by death. She ran a shaking hand through her hair. I don't usually let myself think about that part of Endovir, she admitted. After I got out, there were nights when I would wake up and think I was back in those cells, and I would have to light every candle in my room to prove I wasn't. They don't just kill you in the mines. They break you. There are thousands of slaves in Endovir, and a good number are from Terrasen. Regardless of what I do with my birthright, I'm going to find a way to free them someday. I will free them. Them, and all the slaves in Calicula, too. So my scars serve as a reminder of that. She'd never said it, but there it was. Once she dealt with the King of Otterlin, if destroying him somehow didn't put an end to the labor camps, she would. Stone by stone, if necessary. Rowan asked,
What happened 10 years ago, Aelin?
I'm not going to talk about that.
If you took up your crown, you could free Endovir far more easily than...
I can't talk about it.
Why?
There was a pit in the memory. A pit she couldn't climb out of if she ever fell in. It wasn't her parents' deaths. She had been able to tell others in vague terms about their murders. That pain was still staggering, still haunted her. But waking up between their corpses wasn't the moment that had shattered everything Aelin Galathinius was and might have been. In the back of her mind, she heard another woman's voice, lovely and frantic. Another woman who... She rubbed her brows again. There is this... rage. she said hoarsely. This despair and hatred and rage that lives and breathes inside me. There is no sanity to it, no gentleness. It is a monster dwelling under my skin. For the past 10 years, I have worked every day, every hour to keep that monster locked up. And the moment I talk about those 2 days, and what happened before and after, that monster is going to break loose and there will be no accounting for what I do. That is how I was able to stand before the King of Otterlin. How I was able to befriend his son and his captain. How I was able to live in that palace. Because I did not give that rage, those memories, 1 inch. And right now I am looking for the tools that might destroy my enemy, and I cannot let out the monster. Because it will make me use those tools against the king. Not put them back as I should. And I might very well destroy the world for spite. So that is why I must be Celaena, not Aelin. Because being Aelin means facing those things and unleashing that monster. Do you understand? For whatever it's worth, I don't think you would destroy the world from spite. His voice turned hard. But I also think you like to suffer. You collect scars because you want proof that you are paying for whatever sins you've committed. And I know this because I've been doing the same damn thing for 200 years. Tell me, do you think you will go to some blessed afterworld? Or do you expect a burning hell? You're hoping for hell. Because how could you face them in the afterworld? Better to suffer, to be damned for eternity and—
That's enough, she whispered.
She must have sounded as miserable and small as she felt, because he turned back to the work table. She shut her eyes, but her heart was thundering. She didn't know how much time passed. After a while, the mattress shifted and groaned, and a warm body pressed against hers. Not holding her, just lying beside her. She didn't open her eyes, but she breathed in the smell of him, the pine and snow, and her pain settled a bit.
At least if you're going to hell,
he said, the vibrations in his chest rumbling against her.
Then we'll be there together.
I feel bad for the Dark God already. He brushed a large hand down her hair, and she almost purred. She hadn't realized just how much she missed being touched by anyone, friend or lover. When I'm back to normal, can I assume you're going to yell at me about almost burning out? He let out a soft laugh, but continued stroking her hair.
You have no idea.
She smiled against the pillow, and his hand stilled for a moment, then started again. After a long while, he murmured,
I have no doubt that you'll be able to free the slaves from the labor camp someday. No matter what name you use.
Her eyes burned behind their lids, but she leaned into his touch some more, even going so far as to put a hand on his broad chest, savoring the steady, assured heartbeat pounding beneath.
Thank you for looking after me,
she said. He grunted. Acceptance or dismissal, she didn't know. Sleep tugged at her, and she followed it into oblivion. Rowan kept her cooped up in his room for a few more days, and even once she told him she was feeling fine, he made her spend an extra half day in bed. She supposed it was nice, having someone, even an overbearing, snarling fey warrior, bothering to care whether she lived or died. Her birthday arrived. 19 somehow felt rather dull, and her sole present was that Rowan left her alone for a few hours. He came back with the news of another demi-fey corpse found near the coast. She asked him to let her see it, but he flat out refused. Barked at her was more like it, and said he'd already gone to see it himself. It was the same pattern. A dried nosebleed, a body drained until only a husk remained, and then a careless dumping. He'd also gone back to that town, where they had been more than happy to see him, since he'd brought gold and silver. And he'd returned to Selena with chocolates, since he claimed to be insulted that she considered his absence a proper birthday present. She tried to embrace him, but he would have none of that, and told her as much. Still, the next time she used the bathing room, she'd snuck behind his chair at the work table and planted a great smacking kiss on his cheek. He'd waved her off and wiped his face with a snarl, but she had the suspicion that he'd let her get past his defenses. It was a mistake to think that finally going back outdoors would be delightful. Selena was standing across a mossy clearing from Rowan, her knees slightly bent, hands in loose fists. Rowan hadn't told her to, but she'd gotten into a defensive position upon seeing the faint gleam in his eyes. Rowan only looked like this when he was about to make her life a living hell, and since they hadn't gone to the temple ruins, she assumed he thought she'd at least mastered one element of her power, despite the events of Beltane, which meant they were on to mastering the next. "Your magic lacks shape," Rowan said at last, standing so still that she envied him for it. "And because it has no shape, you have little control. As a form of attack, a fireball or wave of flame is useful, yes. But if you are engaging a skilled combatant, if you want to be able to use your power, then you have to learn to fight with it." She groaned. "But," he added sharply, "you have one advantage that many magic wielders do not. You already know how to fight with weapons." First chocolates on my birthday, now an actual compliment.
His eyes narrowed, and they had yet another of their wordless conversations.
"The more you talk, the more I'm going to make you pay in a moment."
She smiled slightly. "Apologies, Master. I am yours to instruct."
"Brat."
He jerked his chin at her.
"Your fire can take whatever form you wish, the only limit being your imagination. And considering your upbringing, should you go on the offensive..."
"You want me to make a sword out of fire?"
"Arrows, daggers, you direct the power. Visualize it, and use it as you would a mortal weapon."
She swallowed. He smirked.
"Afraid to play with fire, princess?"
"You won't be happy if I singe your eyebrows off."
"Try me." "When you trained as an assassin, what was the first thing you learned?"
"How to defend myself."
She understood why he'd looked so amused for the past few minutes, when he said,
"Good."
Not surprisingly, having ice daggers thrown at her was miserable. Rowan hurled dagger after magical dagger at her, and every damn time the shield of fire that she tried, and failed to imagine, did nothing. If it appeared at all, it always manifested too far to the left or right. Rowan didn't want a wall of flame. No, he wanted a small, controlled shield, and it didn't matter how many times he nicked her hands or arms or face. It didn't matter that dried blood was now itching down her cheeks. One shield. That was all she had to craft, and he would stop. Sweating and panting, Selena was beginning to wonder if she should step directly into the path of his next dagger and put herself out of her suffering, when Rowan growled,
"Try harder."
"I am trying," she snapped, rolling aside as he sent two gleaming ice daggers at her head.
"You're acting like you're on the verge of a burnout."
"Maybe I am."
"If you believe for one moment that you're close to a burnout after an hour of practicing..."
"It happened that quickly on Beltane."
"That was not the end of your power."
His next ice dagger hovered in the air beside his head.
"You fell into the lure of the magic and let it do what it wanted."
let it consume you. Had you kept your head, you could have had those fires burning for weeks, months.
No.
She didn't have any better answer than that. His nostrils flared slightly. I knew it. You wanted your power to be insignificant. You were relieved when you thought that was all you had.
Without warning, he sent the dagger, then the next at her. She raised her left arm as she would raise a shield, picturing the flame surrounding her arm, blocking those daggers, obliterating them. But she cursed so loudly that the birds stopped their chatter.
She clutched her forearm as blood welled and soaked into her tunic.
Stop hitting me! I get the point!
But another dagger came, and another. Ducking and dodging, raising her bloodied arm again and again, she gritted her teeth and swore at him. He sent a dagger twirling with deadly efficiency, and she couldn't move fast enough to avoid the thin scratch along her cheekbone. She hissed. He was right. He was always right, and she hated that. Almost as much as she hated the power that flooded her and did what it wanted. It was hers to command, not the other way around. She was not its slave. She was no one's slave anymore. And if Rowan threw one more damned dagger at her face, he did. The ice crystal didn't make it past her upraised forearm before it vanished in a hiss of steam. Selena gazed over the flickering edge of the compact red-burning flame before her arm, shaped like a shield. Rowan smiled slowly.
We're done for today. Go eat something.
The circular shield did not burn her, though its flames swirled and sizzled. As she'd commanded, it had worked. So she raised her eyes to Rowan. No. Again. After a week of making shields of various sizes and temperatures, Selena could have multiple defenses burning at once and encircle the entire glen with half a thought to protect it from outside assault. And when she awoke one morning before dawn, she couldn't say why she did it, but she slipped from the room she shared with Rowan and went down to the Wardstones. She shivered from more than the early morning cold as the power of the curving gate stones zinged against her skin when she passed through. But none of the sentries on the battlements ordered her to stop as she walked along the line of towering carved rocks until she found a bit of even ground and began to practice. Chapter 44. As one, the 13 flew. As one, the 13 led the other Blackbeak covens in the skies. Drill after drill, through rain and sun and wind, until they were all tanned and freckled. Even though Abraxos had yet to make the crossing, the spider silk patching on his wings improved his flying significantly. It was all going beautifully. Abraxos had gotten into a brawl for dominance with Lynn's bull and emerged victorious, and after that, none in her coven or any other challenged him. The war games were fast approaching, and though Iskra hadn't been in any trouble since the night Manon had half-killed her, they watched their backs, in the baths, around every dark corner, double-checking every rein and strap before they mounted their wyverns. Yes. It was all going beautifully, until Manon was summoned to her grandmother's room. "Why is it?" her grandmother said by way of greeting, pacing the room, teeth always out. "That I have to hear from God's damned Cressida that your runty, useless wyvern hasn't made the crossing. Why is it that I am in the middle of a meeting, planning these war games so you can win?" And the other matrons tell me that you aren't allowed to participate because your mount will not make the crossing and therefore isn't allowed to fly in the host.
Manon glimpsed the flash of nails before they raked down her cheek. Not hard enough to scar, but enough to bleed.
You and that beast are an embarrassment, her grandmother hissed, teeth snapping in her face. All I want is for you to win these games, so we can take our rightful place as queens, not high witches. Queens of the Waste, Manon. And you are doing your best to ruin it.
Manon kept her eyes on the ground. Her grandmother dug a nail into her chest, cutting through her red cloak, piercing the flesh right above her heart.
Has your heart melted?
No.
No,
her grandmother sneered.
No, it cannot melt, because you do not have a heart, Manon. We are not born with them, and we are glad of it.
She pointed to the stone floor.
Why is it that I am informed today that Iskra caught a god's-damned Kraken spying on us? Why am I the last to know that she is in our dungeons, and that they have been interrogating her for 2 days?
Manon blinked, but that was all the surprise she let show. If Krakens were spying on them. Another slice to the face, marring the other cheek.
You will make the crossing tomorrow, Manon. Tomorrow. And I don't care if you splatter yourself on the rocks. If you live, you had better pray to the darkness that you win those games. Because if you don't...
Her grandmother sliced a nail across Manon's throat. A scratch to set the blood running. And a promise. Everyone came this time to watch the crossing. Abraxos was saddled, focus pinned on the cave mouth open to the night beyond. Asterin and Sorrel were behind her, but beside their mounts, not astride them. Her grandmother had gotten wind of how they planned to save her and forbidden it. It was Manon's own stupidity and pride that had to pay, she'd said. Witches lined the viewing platform, and from high above, the high witches and their heirs watched from a small balcony. The noise was near deafening. Manon glanced at Asterin and Sorrel and found them looking stone-cold, fierce, but tense.
Keep to the walls so he doesn't spook your wyverns, she told them.
They nodded grimly. Since grafting the spider silk onto Abraxos's wings, Manon had been careful not to push him too hard until the healing was absolutely complete. But the crossing, with its plunge and winds. His wings could be shredded in a matter of seconds if the silk didn't hold.
We're waiting, Manon, her grandmother barked from above. She waved a hand toward the cave mouth. But by all means, take your time.
Laughter. From the yellow legs, black beaks. Everyone. Yet Petra wasn't smiling, and none of the 13, gathered closest along the viewing platform, were smiling either. Manon turned to Abraxos, looking into those eyes.
Let's go.
She tugged on the reins. But he refused to move, not from fear or terror. He slowly lifted his head, looking to where her grandmother stood, and let out a low warning growl. A threat. Manon knew she should reprimand him for the disrespect, but the fact that he could grasp what was occurring in this hall, it should have been impossible.
The night is waning, her grandmother called, heedless of the beast that stared at her with such rage in his eyes.
Sorrel and Asterin exchanged glances, and she could have sworn her second's hand twitched toward the hilt of her sword. Not to hurt Abraxos, but... Every single one of the 13 was casually reaching for their weapons, to fight their way out, in case her grandmother gave the order to have Manon and Abraxos put down. They'd heard the challenge in Abraxos's growl, understood that the beast had drawn a line in the sand. They were not born with hearts, her grandmother said.
They had all been told that. Obedience, discipline, brutality. Those were the things they were supposed to cherish. Astarine's eyes were bright, stunningly bright, and she nodded once at Manon. It was that same feeling she'd gotten when Iskra whipped Abraxos. That thing she couldn't describe, but it blinded her. Manon gripped Abraxos's snout, forcing his gaze away from her grandmother. "Just once," she whispered. "All you have to do is make this jump just once, Abraxos, and then you can shut them up forever." Then, rising up from the deep, there came a steady two-note beat. The beat of the chained bait beasts who hauled the massive machines around, like a thudding heart, or beating wings. Louder the beat sounded, as if the wyverns down in the pits knew what was happening. It grew and grew, until it reached the cavern, until Astarine reached for her shield and joined in, until each one of the 13 took up the beat. "You hear that? That is for you." For a moment, as the beat pulsed around them, phantom wings from the mountain itself, Manon thought that it would not be so bad to die. If it was with him, if she was not alone. "You are one of the 13, she said to him, "from now until the darkness cleaves us apart. You are mine, and I am yours. Let's show them why." He huffed into her palms as if to say he already knew all of that, and that she was just wasting time. She smiled faintly, even as Abraxos cast another challenging glare in her grandmother's direction. The wyvern lowered himself to the ground for Manon to climb into the saddle. The distance to the entrance seemed so much shorter in the saddle than on foot. But she did not let herself doubt him as she blinked her inner lid into place and retracted her teeth. The spider silk would hold. She would consider no other alternative. "Fly, Abraxos," she told him, and dug her spurs into his sides. Like a roaring star, he thundered down the long chute, and Manon moved with him, meeting each gallop of his powerful body, each step in time with the beat of the wyverns locked in the belly of the mountain. Abraxos flapped his wings open, pounding them once, twice, gathering speed, fearless, unrelenting, ready. Still, the beat did not stop, not from the wyverns or from the 13 or from the blackbeak covens, who picked it up, stomping their feet or clapping their hands. Not from the blue blood heir, who clapped her sword against her dagger, or the blue blood witches who followed her lead. The entire mountain shook with the sound. Faster and faster, Abraxos raced for the drop, and Manon held on tight. The cave mouth opened wide. Abraxos tucked in his wings, using the movement to give his body one last shove over the lip as he took Manon with him, and plunged. Fast as lightning arcing across the sky, he plummeted toward the gap floor. Manon rose up into the saddle, clinging as her braid ripped free from her cloak, then came loose from its bonds, pulling painfully behind her, making her eyes water despite the lids. Down and down he fell, wings tucked in tight, tail straight and balanced. Down into hell, into eternity, into that world where, for a moment, she could have sworn that something tightened in her chest. She did not shut her eyes, not as the moon-illuminated stones of the gap became closer, clearer. She did not need to. Like the sails of a mighty ship, Abraxos's wings unfurled, snapping tight. He tilted them upward, pulling against the death trying to drag them down. And it was those wings, covered in glimmering patches of spider silk, that stayed strong and sturdy, sending them soaring clean up the side of the Omega and into the starry sky beyond. Chapter 45. To their credit, the sentries didn't jump when Rowan shifted beside them atop the battlement wall. They had eyes keen enough to have detected his arrival as he swooped in. A slight tang of fear leaked from them, but that was to be expected, even if it troubled him more than it had in the past. But they did stir slightly when he spoke.
"How long has she been down there?"
"An hour, Prince," one said, watching the flashing flames below.
"For how many mornings in a row?"
"This is the fourth, Prince,"
the same sentry replied. The first 3 days she'd slipped from bed before dawn, he'd assumed she'd been helping in the kitchens. But when they'd trained yesterday, she'd improved at a rate she shouldn't have, as if overnight. He had to give her credit for resourcefulness. The girl stood outside the ward stones, fighting with herself. A dagger of flame flew from her hand toward the invisible barrier between two stones, then another, as if racing for the head of an opponent. It hit the magic wall with a flash of light and bounced back, reflected off the protective spell encircling the fortress. And when it reached her, she shielded, swift, strong, sure, a warrior on a battlefield.
"I've never seen anyone fight like that," the sentry said.
It was a question, but Rowan didn't bother to answer. It wasn't their business, and he wasn't entirely certain if his queen would be pleased with the demi-fae learning to use their powers in such a way. Though he fully planned to tell Lorcan, his commander, and the only male who outranked him in Dorinel, just to see whether they could use it in their training. The girl moved from throwing weapons to hand-to-hand combat. A punch of power, a sweeping kick of flame. Her flames had become gloriously varied, golds and reds and oranges. And her technique, not the magic, but the way she moved. Her master had been a monster, there was no doubt of that. But he had trained her thoroughly. She ducked and flipped and twisted, relentless, raging, and she swore with her usual color as the wall sent the punch of ruby flame back at her. She managed to shield, but still got knocked on her ass. Yet none of the sentries laughed. Rowan didn't know if it was because of his presence or because of her. He got his answer a heartbeat later, as he waited for her to shout or shriek or walk away. But the princess just slowly got to her feet, not bothering to brush off the dirt and leaves, and kept practicing. The next corpse appeared a week later, setting a rather wretched tone for the crisp spring morning, as Selena and Rowan ran for the site. They'd spent the past week fighting and defending and manipulating her magic, interrupted only by a rather miserable visit from some fey nobility traveling through the area, which left Selena in no hurry to set foot in Dorinel. Thankfully, the guests stayed for one night, hardly disrupting her lessons. They worked only with fire, ignoring the drop of water affinity that she'd been given. She tried again and again to summon the water, when she was drinking, while in the bath, when it rained, but to no avail. Fire it was, then. And while she knew Rowan was aware of her early morning practicing, he never lightened her training, though she could have sworn she occasionally felt their magic playing together, her flame taunting his ice, his wind dancing amongst her embers. But each morning brought something new, something harder and different and miserable. Gods, he was brilliant, cunning and wicked and brilliant. Even when he beat the hell out of her, every damn day. Not from malice, not like it had been before, but to prove his point. Her enemies would give no quarter. If she needed to pause, if her power faltered, she died. So he knocked her into the mud or the stream or the grass with a blast of wind or ice. So she rose, shooting arrows aflame, her shield now her strongest ally. Again and again, hungry and exhausted and soaking with rain and mist and sweat. Until shielding was an instinct. Until she could hurl arrows and daggers aflame together. Until she knocked him on his ass. There was always more to learn. She lived and breathed and dreamt of fire. Sometimes, though, her dreams were of a brown-eyed man in an empire across the sea. Sometimes she'd awaken and reach for the warm male body beside hers, only to realize it was not the captain. That she would never again lie next to Kaol, not after what had happened. And when she remembered that, it sometimes hurt to breathe. There was nothing romantic about sharing a bed with Rowan, and they kept to their own sides. There was certainly nothing romantic about it when they reached the side of the corpse, and she peeled off her shirt to cool down. In nothing but her underclothes, Selena's skin was bitten by the sea air with a delightful chill, and even Rowan unbuttoned his heavy jacket as they carefully approached the coordinates. "Well, I can certainly smell him this time," Selena said between panting breaths. They'd reached the site in little less than 3 hours, guessing by the sun. That was faster and longer than she'd ever run, thanks to the fae form she'd been training in.
"This body has been rotting here longer than the demi-fae from 3 days ago."
She bit back her retort. There had been another demi-fae body found, and he hadn't let her go see it, instead forcing her to practice all day while he flew to the site. But this morning, he'd taken one look at the fire smoldering in her eyes and relented. Selena stepped carefully on the pine carpet, scanning for any signs of a fight or of the attacker. The ground was churned up, and despite the rushing stream, the flies were buzzing near what appeared to be a heap of clothing peeking from behind a small boulder. Rowan swore, low and viciously, even lifting his forearm to cover his nose and mouth as he examined the husk that remained. The demi-fae male's face twisted in horror. Selena might have done the same, except that second smell was here too. Not as strong as it had been at the first sight, but it lingered. She shoved back against the memory that wanted to rise in response to the smell, the memory that had overwhelmed her that day in the barrow field. "It has our attention, and it knows it," she said. "It's targeting demi-fae, either to send a message or because they taste good. But..." She pictured the map Rowan kept in his room, detailing the wide area where the corpses had been found, and winced. "What if there's more than one?" Rowan looked back at her, brows high. She didn't say anything else until she had moved to where he stood by the body, careful not to disturb any clues. Her stomach lurched, and bile stung the back of her throat, but she clamped down on the horror with a wall of ice that even her fire could not melt. "You're old as hell," she said. "You must have considered that we're dealing with a few of them, given how vast the territory is. What if the one we saw in the barrows wasn't even the creature responsible for these bodies?" He narrowed his eyes, but conceded a nod. She studied the hollowed-out face, the torn clothes. Torn clothes? What looked like small cuts along the palms, as if he'd dug in his fingernails. The others had barely been touched, but this... "Rowan?" She waved away flies. "Rowan, tell me you see what I'm seeing." another vicious curse. He crouched, using the tip of a dagger to push back a bit of clothing torn at the collar.
This male
fought. He fought back against it. None of the others did, according to the reports. The stench of the corpse was nearly enough to bring her to her knees, but she squatted by the decaying hand and forearm, shriveled and wasted from the inside out. She held out a hand for Rowan's dagger, still possessing none of her own. He hesitated as she looked up at him.
"Only for the afternoon,"
he seemed to growl, as he pressed the hilt into her open palm. She yanked down the dagger.
"I know, I know. I haven't earned my weapons back yet. Don't get your feathers ruffled."
She turned back to the husk, cutting off their wordless conversation and getting a snarl in response. Butting heads with Rowan was the least of her concerns, even if it had become one of her favorite activities. There was something so familiar about doing this, she thought, as she carefully, as gently and respectfully as she could, ran the tip of the dagger under the male's cracked and filthy nails, then smeared the contents on the back of her own hand. Dirt and black. Black.
"What the hell is that?"
Rowan demanded, kneeling beside her, sniffing her outstretched hand. He jerked back, snarling.
"That's not dirt."
No, it wasn't. It was blacker than night, and reeked just as badly as it had the first time she'd smelled it, in the catacombs beneath the library, an obsidian oily pool of blood. Slightly different from that other horrific smell that loitered around this place, but similar. So similar to...
"This isn't possible," she said, jolting to her feet. This,
she paced, if only to keep from shaking.
"I'm wrong. I have to be wrong."
There had been so many cells in that forgotten dungeon beneath the library, beneath the king's wordstone clock tower. The creature she'd encountered there had possessed a human heart. It had been left, she'd suspected, because of some defect. What if the perfected ones had been moved elsewhere? What if they were now ready?
"Tell me,"
Rowan growled, the words barely understandable as he seemed to struggle to rein in the killing edge he rode in response to the threat lurking somewhere in these woods. She lifted her hand to rub her eyes, but realized what was on her fingers and went to wipe them on her shirt, only to recall that she was wearing nothing but the soft white band around her breasts, and that she was cold to her very bones. She rushed to the nearby stream to scrub off the dried black blood, hating even that the trace of it would be in the water, in the world, and quickly, quietly, told Rowan of the creature in the library, the word keys, and the information Maeve held hostage regarding how to destroy that power. Power that was being used by the king to make things, and targeting people with magic in their blood to be their hosts. A warm breeze wrapped around her, heating her bones and blood, steadying her.
"How did it get here?"
Rowan asked, his features now set with icy calm.
"I don't know. I hope I'm wrong.
But that smell... I'll never forget that smell as long as I live. Like it had rotted from the inside out, its very essence ruined. But it retained some cognitive abilities, and whatever this is, it must have them too, if it's dumping the bodies."
She tried to swallow, twice, but her mouth was dry.
Demi-fae. They would make perfect hosts, with so many of them able to use magic, and no one in Wendlin or Doranel caring if they live or die. But these corpses...
If he wanted to kidnap them, why kill them?
Unless they weren't compatible, Rowan said. And if they weren't compatible, then what better use for them than to drain them dry?
But what's the point of leaving the bodies where we can find them? To drum up fear? Rowan ground his jaw and stalked through the area, examining the ground, the trees, the rocks.
Burn the body, Aelin.
He removed the sheath and belt that had housed the dagger still dangling from her hand and tossed them to her. She caught them with her free hand.
We're going hunting.
They found nothing, even when Rowan shifted into his other form and circled high above. As the light grew dim, they climbed into the biggest, densest tree in the area. They squeezed onto a massive branch, huddling together, as he would not let her summon even a flicker of flame. When she complained about the conditions, Rowan pointed out that there was no moon that night, and worse things than the skinwalkers prowled the woods. That shut her up, until he asked her to tell him more about the creature in the library, to explain every detail and weakness and strength. After she finished, he took out one of his long knives, a fraction of the marvelous assortment he carried, and began cleaning it. With her heightened senses, she could see enough in the starlight to make out the steel, his hands, and the shifting muscles in his shoulders as he wiped the blade. He himself was a beautiful weapon, forged by centuries of ruthless training and warring. "Do you think I was mistaken?" she said as he put away the knife and reached for the ones hidden beneath his clothes. Like the first, none of them were dirty, but she didn't point it out. "About the creature, I mean." Rowan slung his shirt over his head to get at the weapons strapped beneath, revealing his broad back, muscled and scarred and glorious. Fine, some very feminine, innate part of her appreciated that. And she didn't mind his half-nakedness. He'd seen every inch of her now. She supposed there was no part of him that would be much of a surprise, either, thanks to Kaol. But no, she wouldn't think about Kaol. Not when she was feeling balanced and clear-headed and good.
We're dealing with a cunning, lethal predator, regardless of where it originated and how many there are, he said,
cleaning a small dagger that had been strapped across his pectoral muscle. She followed the path of his tattoo down his face, neck, shoulders, and arm. Such a stark, brutal marking. Had the scars on Kaol's face healed, or would they be a permanent reminder of what she'd done to him?
If you were mistaken, I'd consider it a blessing.
She slumped against the trunk. That was twice now she'd thought of Kaol. She must be truly exhausted, because the only other option was that she just wanted to make herself feel miserable. She didn't want to know what Kaol had been doing these months, or what he now thought of her. If he'd sold the information about her past to the king, maybe the king had sent one of those things here to hunt her. And Dorian, gods, she'd been so lost in her own misery that she'd hardly wondered about him, whether he'd managed to keep his magic secret. She prayed he was safe. She suffered with her own thoughts until Rowan finished with his weapons, then took out their skin of water and rinsed his hands, neck, and chest. She watched him sidelong, the way the water gleamed on his skin in the starlight. It was a damn good thing Rowan had no interest in her, either, because she knew she was stupid and reckless enough to consider whether moving on in the physical sense might solve the problem of Kaol. There was still such a mighty hole in her chest. A hole that grew bigger, not smaller, and that no one could fix, not even if she took Rowan to bed. There were some days when the amethyst ring was her most precious belonging, others when it was all she could do not to melt it down in a flame of her own making. Maybe she had been a fool to love a man who served the king.
But Kaol had been what she needed after losing Sam, after surviving the mines. But these days, she didn't know what she needed, what she wanted. If she felt like admitting it, she actually didn't have the faintest clue who the hell she was anymore. All she knew was that whatever and whoever climbed out of that abyss of despair and grief would not be the same person who had plummeted in. And maybe that was a good thing. Rowan put his clothes back on and settled against the trunk, his body warm and solid against hers. They sat in the dark for a little, until she said quietly, "You once told me that when you find your mate, you can't stomach the idea of hurting them physically. Once you're mated, you'd sooner harm yourself."
"Yes? Why?"
"I tried to kill him. I mauled his face, then held a dagger over his heart because I thought he was responsible for Nehemia's death. I would have done it if someone hadn't stopped me. If he'd truly been my mate, I wouldn't have been able to do that, would I?" He was silent for a long while.
"You hadn't been in your fae form for 10 years, so perhaps your instincts weren't even able to take hold. Sometimes, mates can be together intimately before the actual bond snaps into place."
"It's a useless hope to cling to, anyway."
"Do you want the truth?"
She tucked her chin into her tunic and closed her eyes. "Not tonight." Chapter 46. Shielding her eyes from the glare, Selena scanned the cliffs and the spit of beach far below. It was scorching, with hardly a breeze, but Rowan remained in his heavy pale gray jacket and wide belt, vambraces strapped to his forearms. He'd deigned to give her a few of his weapons that morning, as a precaution. They'd returned to the latest site at dawn to retrace their steps, and that was where Selena had picked up a trail. Well, she'd spied a droplet of dark blood on a nearby rock, and then Rowan had followed the scent back toward the cliffs. She looked down the beach, at the natural cut arches of the many caves along its curving length. But there was nothing here. And the trail, thanks to the sea and wind and elements, had gone cold. They'd been here for the past half hour, looking for any other signs, but there was nothing. Nothing. Except there. A sagging curve in the cliff edge, as if many pairs of feet had worn the lip down as they slid carefully over the edge. Rowan gripped her arm as she leaned to view the crumbled, hidden stair. She glared at him, but he didn't let go. "I'm trying not to be insulted," she said. "Look." There were hardly steps now, just lumps of rock and sand peppered with shrubs. The water beyond the beach was so clear and calm that a slight break could be seen in the barrier reef that guarded these shores. It was one of the few ways to make a safe landing here without shattering your boat, only wide enough for a small craft to pass through. No warships or merchant vessels would fit, undoubtedly one reason this area had never been developed. It was the perfect place, however, if you wanted to surreptitiously enter the country and stay hidden. She began sketching in the sandy earth, a long, hard line, then drew dot after dot after dot. "The bodies were dumped in streams and rivers," she said.
"The sea was never far off," he said, kneeling beside her. "They could have dumped the bodies there, but..."
"But then those bodies probably would drift back to the shore and prompt people to look along the beach. Look here," she said, pointing to the stretch of coastline she'd sketched and where they were currently sitting, smack dab in the middle of it.
"There are countless caves along this section of the shore."
She indicated where the waves broke on the reef and the small, calm space between them. It's an easy access point from...
She swore.
She couldn't say it. There were no ships along here, but that didn't mean that one or two or more couldn't have come from Otterlin, sneaking in at night, and slipped in their violent, vicious cargo using smaller boats. Rowan stood.
We're leaving. Now.
Don't you think they would already have attacked if they'd seen us? Rowan pointed to the sun. If he was about to tell her it wasn't safe for a queen to be throwing herself into danger, then he could...
If we're going to explore, then we're going to do it under cover of darkness. So we're going back to the stream, and we're going to find something to eat. And then, princess, he said with a wild grin, we are going to have some fun.
Some god must have decided to take pity on them, because the rain started right after sunset, thundering clouds rolling in with a vengeance to conceal any sound they made as they returned to the beach and began a thorough search of the caves. But that was about where their favor from the gods ended, because what they found, while lying on their bellies on a narrow cliff overhanging a barren beach, was worse than anything they'd anticipated. It wasn't only monsters of the king's making. It was a host of soldiers. A few men came out of the massive cave mouth, which was camouflaged among the rocks and sand. They might have missed them had it not been for Rowan's keen sense of smell. He did not have the words, he said, to describe what that smell was like. But she knew it. Selena's mouth had gone dry, her stomach a knot as the dark figures slipped in and out of the cave with disciplined economic movements that suggested they were highly trained. They weren't rabid, half-feral monsters like the one in the library, or cold, flawless creatures like what she'd seen in the barrows, but mortal soldiers. All of them aware, disciplined, ruthless. The crabmonger, Selena murmured to Rowan. In the village. He said he found weapons in his nets. They must be taking ships and then getting close enough to swim through the reef without attracting attention. We need to get a closer look. She raised her brows at Rowan, who gave her a hunter's smile. I knew you'd be useful someday. Rowan just snorted and shifted, a flicker of light that she hoped was gobbled up by the storm. He flapped over the cliff edge and glided across the water, nothing more than a predator looking for a meal, then circled back until he rested on a rock just beyond the breaking waves. She watched him hunt, moving toward the cave itself, an animal looking for shelter from the rain. And then, keeping close to the towering ceiling of the cave, he swept inside. She didn't breathe the entire time he was out of her sight. She counted the gaps between the thunder and the lightning, her fingers itching to grab onto the hilt of her sword. But at long last, Rowan swooped out of the cave in a leisurely flight. He made his way up to her, then flew past, heading into the woods.